Hello and welcome to WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And Sean has a story to tell you. I'll just let him get it out of the way.
Let's just go. So,
right into the skid.
Yeah, literally right before we started recording this podcast that you are now listening to. I have, like, some Mountain Dew up in my condo, and so Jonathan's like, oh, hey, before we start this, can I get a Mountain Dew? I'm like, yeah, sure, go ahead. It's right in the fridge. And so he gets up from his chair, takes one step, like, his foot didn't get caught in his backpack, because his backpack's right next to his chair. I want to make clear, it didn't get, like, tied up in the backpack strap or anything. You just kind of kicked the backpack, and then you stumbled, and then there was, like, a slight, like, quarter-second pause after you stumbled. And then you just completely fell on the ground and, like, hit your, like, back against the closet. Just, like, it was one of the most spectacular falls I've seen in, like, 10 years. It was fucking amazing. Out of nothing. Like, there was, like, nothing really to trip on. You, like, were barely even moving in the first place. It was, like, your first step you took after you got up. It was fucking awesome.
And see, for whatever reason, I have almost fallen like that, like, 8 times in the past week.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know.
Well, I hate to have to tell you this, Jonathan, but you are a pretty clumsy person.
I'm very clumsy,
yeah, like,
yes.
I've known you for a while now. I'm honestly not at all surprised that you tripped and fell completely. Like, you didn't fucking trip, you just fell.
Here's what surprises me. We've known each other for a long time. I'm amazed this is the first time you've seen me fall like that.
I don't think I've ever seen you fall, like, quite that spectacular before. Like, I've seen you stumble and trip multiple times, but that was, like, that was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
usually I blame my clumsiness on my gigantic feet that I get tripped. I just trip over my own feet, literally. But that was something else. That was worse than me tripping over my own feet.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was.
So, awesome. Great, great start to the podcast, I thought.
Yeah, I think it primed us, got us all punchy, you know, energized.
But anyways, we're not here to talk about your personal failings and your physical maneuvering of your body.
I kind of wish instead of Mountain Dew you would have had some kind of hard liquor in
your
refrigerator so I could drain my sorrows.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'd rather have the Mountain Dew, honestly. But
me too. It's, yeah.
But anyways, seriously though, we're not here to talk about how clumsy you are and how just of a failure you are as a human person in terms of, like, your ability to maneuver in any way. We're here to talk about...
Stuff.
What the fuck... Yeah, what are we here to talk about? There's nothing really big going on today.
But,
there's a lot... Whole shit, a lot, ton of stuff happening tomorrow.
Tomorrow is Grand Theft Auto 5 Day, as you all know. We cannot wait. We're gonna, you know, talk about it in depth next time. I don't know if we'll both be able to get through the whole campaign by then, but we'll definitely be able to say... Wasn't it awesome when X happened, or, you know, I ran over 5 people in an ATV, that was awesome.
When I just killed, like, 20 people just because I don't like it.
I'm really curious to see, personally, whether or not all the sort of moral progress I've made playing Mass Effect and becoming a paragon and a hero will transfer
to
Grand Theft Auto, or if it'll all just immediately regress.
You'll just be the horrible sociopathic monster you are again. Yeah.
There'll just be too much temptation.
Sure.
That's the theme of Grand Theft Auto, right?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think, like, the game doesn't, like, really specifically tempt you, and Red Dead doesn't do this either, to just, like, kill random people, because you don't really get shit for that. It's not like they give you a bunch of money or, like, points or something.
Yeah.
All it gives you is this, like, carnal, sadistic satisfaction you get from seeing a digital avatar being brutally murdered. That's all it gives you.
Right. In any case, because this is a calm before the storm sort of episode, we're going to
calm after the storm for me, but sure.
We'll talk about that in a second. We're going to have 2 main subjects today. We're going to do a little GTA retrospective, talk about past Grand Theft Auto fun we've had, kind of lead up to our thoughts on GTA 5, our hopes and dreams for it, that sort of thing. And then we're going to do a little retrospective on the Mass Effect trilogy. I don't know how long or what form this conversation will take.
Yeah, like, for me, I kind of would more specifically just want to talk about the ending to Mass Effect 3 instead
and that's
of doing,
what I,
like, the whole series.
Yeah,
that'd be a huge discussion.
Right, and that's what I want to talk about, too. We have talked multiple times on this podcast about the Mass Effect trilogy, but we've never gone in depth on the ending, in part because sometimes it just wasn't the forum for that.
Yeah.
Sometimes because I didn't finish it until this weekend.
Yes.
But
that's
reason why. I have finished it. I finished it on Friday night. This is Monday. I've pretty much spent the whole weekend in a daze just going over the ending in my head over and over. I think it's one of the absolute most intellectually and emotionally satisfying things I've ever seen in fiction. I'm really excited to talk with you a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. So we'll do those two things. Mass Effect will be at the end in case, you know, you haven't finished it yet or something. We'll have another couple of little discussions before then, including, we are kind of lucky this podcast is even happening.
Yeah.
Because if you've been reading the news, and this is on, we've even made, you know, every news station in the country.
This area has been declared a major disaster area by the president. So,
as you know, we are in Boulder.
Get that sick FEMA money, motherfucker.
We record this podcast in Boulder, Colorado, which God hates.
Apparently,
he sent a biblical flood our way.
Yeah, he did,
and it's been pretty awful. I live in Golden, so I escaped the worst of it in flooding terms, but my windows leak, so that was pretty hellish.
Yeah.
All weekend long dealing with that. But what was it like up here for you, Sean, in the eye of the storm?
I mean, yeah, it was pretty fucking crazy. So basically how it all went was, what, it was Wednesday when it, like, started raining, and it was raining all Wednesday, but, like, it wasn't so bad you couldn't do anything, so it's like we all had classes. And then Wednesday night is when, like, the flash flood emergency warnings and shit started happening, where it's like, and that's when you start seeing videos of dumb college kids at, like, tunnels being, look how high the water is in this tunnel! Like, we're gonna, like, raft in it! And it's like, you could be dead in fucking seconds, you goddamn idiots! And so, yeah, so, like, Wednesday night is where it got really, really bad. And then Thursday is where it got really, 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 really bad, because it rained, like, heavily all through Wednesday night and all through Thursday. It did not let up until, like, Thursday, like late Thursday night, and then Friday, it was kind of fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it flooded. Like, yeah, it's just, like, there was a lot of fucking water everywhere. Luckily, my condo, since it's sort of, like, situated on the middle of, like, a hill, like, coming from, like, the campus down, is all a hill this way, and we're situated right on a, like, large intersection, so the water didn't really affect our condo that much, because it didn't have, like, a chance to pile up since it was on a hill. And then there's just, like, a lot of sort of, like, flat ground around us. We're not, like, in a canyon sort of area. So I was totally fucking fine. I basically
Real estate-wise, you made a good choice,
yeah,
Sean.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so I basically spent most of the flooding staying inside, because I'm not a fucking moron. I know flash floods are fucking dangerous. Water is super fucking dangerous if there's enough of it. Like, it's no goddamn joke. And so, yeah, like, I spent most of Wednesday night and Thursday looking outside my window at people standing at the intersection, like, taking fucking pictures and videos on their iPhones of all the water rushing through, and just being like, what the fuck are you people doing? Like, why is it so, what is with our society that it is so goddamn important for us to record in picture and video absolutely everything that happens to us, instead of just trying to fucking remember it yourself?
I actually have a funny story about this.
Sure, go ahead.
I was about to tell a story. My family and I was with my mom. We were going to go meet my little brother, who's in college now. We were going to go up to Fort Collins and meet him for lunch over the weekend. This was by the time the flash flooding warnings had stopped. Okay. But anyway, there was a big rainbow in the sky. So we're leaving, and my mom's driving, and she stops, she's like, rainbow, and she stops the car. And by the way, while she's driving, she doesn't look at the road at all. She's looking up at the rainbow, and there are cars all over our street, because it's a fucking residential area, and she almost runs into all of them. I had to grab the steering wheel at one point. And she finally stops, and she's like, okay, I'm going to take a picture. And she takes, like, 20 pictures of the fucking rainbow. She drives another 5 feet, stops the fucking car, takes another 20 pictures of the friggin' rainbow. I'm like, Mom, it's a rainbow. It's stupid.
It's yes, exactly. It's light dispersed along the water in the atmosphere that separates it out into the visual spectrum so you can see the different colors. Like, fantastic.
Yeah, it's just a rainbow.
I can do that on my fucking computer if I wanted to.
And you know what does not look cool in pictures? Rainbows.
Yeah.
Rainbows.
I mean, nothing, like, really does like
no.
that. Unless you've got, you know, like, I was kind of entertained at one point of, like, looking. I mean, entertained is a weird word for it, but I spent a lot of time on Thursday looking at all the pictures from, like professional photographers and, like, news organizations and stuff of flooding in the mountainous areas, because in the mountains is where you get super fucked. Like, there's the town of Lyons has been, like, completely evacuated. The National Guard got called out because it was 100% cut off. They had, like, they lost all their facilities and services. So it's like, I was watching, like, looking at pictures and videos taken from professional fucking people that's their goddamn job, and it's like, oh, like, these are really interesting, and it's like, holy shit, look at this flood. It's like, I don't want to look at someone's fucking dumb picture they took, like, shaky video they took on their iPhone at the intersection looking at the water going down the fucking street, you know?
Yeah.
It's so stupid. I I don't understand the impulse of people whatsoever. Because it's like, I don't even... I prefer the memory of it.
I do too.
The memory is so much more interesting because it's like just having the picture. It's like, oh, that's what it was like. And then when you have the memory of it, it sort of gets like romanticized and glorified in a weird way. It's way cooler.
I completely agree. Like when I've been to places like the Grand Canyon or something, or the monument with Mount Rushmore, stuff like that, I don't want to look at it through my phone. I want to look at it and be like, this is amazing. Or like when I go to a concert or something, everyone's got their phones out. It's like, let's take a picture of Bruce Springsteen. It's like, Bruce Springsteen's like 5 feet from me. I want to look at the guy, not look at him through my phone. That's what I do when I watch concert DVDs.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. Just the picture impulse doesn't make sense to me. And my mom stopped several more times to take pictures of that stupid rainbow.
Yeah.
But anyway, then we were in areas like Lafayette and Loveland, and the flooding, like, it's one thing to see that in pictures, to see the flooding in real life, just these areas that I've been to and seen before, like farmlands and stuff, that are just underwater. It's crazy.
Yeah. And like for me, so on Friday, like I said, is when the flooding let up, and actually, like, Thursday morning, like from, like, 8 to 10, maybe, it stopped raining. Like, there was still, like, a shit ton of water outside, but it was, like, the water wasn't getting higher, so it was more or less safe to go around as long as you didn't go to any place you seriously should not go, like a tunnel or something. And right. So I sort of, like, walked around and saw what the town was like. And then on Friday, when it, like, completely stopped, I, like, walked around a lot more just to see, like, oh, hey, like, after that much water comes through, it's, like, it's something I never thought about. Everything's just dirty. Absolutely everything is just, like, covered in, like, this little layer of dirt that's just been carried down from, like, the mountains and shit by the water. But it was, like, because I have this, like, there's this one bench by Boulder Creek that I like to sit at and read a lot. Because it's just, like, a really nice, peaceful little area. So I was, like, walking over there. And it was, like, on Friday, I couldn't even see the bench anymore. Because it's, like, the water had gotten so high. Like, luckily, the bench is still there. So someday, I may be able to go back there and read. It's like the water level is still way too high to actually do it right now. But it's like, it's so fucking crazy just seeing like Boulder Creek being literally like 100 times more water than it normally is. And it's all really brown and gross raw water.
Yeah.
But that leads me to my favorite, like I don't want to go on and on about the flood stuff. My favorite part of all the flood shit was on Friday. And I'm going to wrap this up also with a flash flood safety warning for just everybody. Because people do dumb shit. And it was great having this happen near the university. Because it's like you see all the dumb college kids doing all the dumb shit. Because college kids are fucking stupid.
Right.
Which makes no sense because they're paying shit tons of money to go to a place to make them not stupid. So maybe that does make sense. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
If they were already not stupid, they wouldn't need to go.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, on Friday I was walking around and I went over to where Boulder Creek is. And right by Boulder Creek is a, like, big park with, like, a playground. Children go there, play, you know, all that stuff. And, like, literally, it is right next to Boulder Creek. And so what happened after the flood is that Boulder Creek obviously got a lot fucking bigger, and it overflowed its bounds and sort of, like, flooded over into the base of this hill that the park was situated on. So it was sort of like this big hill that people use for, like, sledding in the wintertime. Like, it's not, like, a huge hill, but it's big enough for, like, the little kids to go sledding on. And then at the base of it is just this, like, probably, like knee-deep pool of just muddy, disgusting, murky flood waters. And so I saw that, and
I think I know where this is going.
Lo and behold, assembled on that hill was about probably 20 to 30 college-age kids, and they had taken a, like, really long bungee cord that you do to do, like, whatever, like, college kids nowadays, they, like, tie these bungee-type cords around two trees, like a balance beam, and try to, like, balance on it. Like, it's at some point that became super popular. I've never done it. It seems really dumb to me, but fucking college kids do it all the time on the campus. It's annoying. But they had taken a really long one of those, wrapped it around a tree that was on one side of the big pool of water, and then, like dragged it and made it, like, completely taut, using the tension, across the pool of water, so they were all standing on the hill holding this really tight, taut bungee cord, and then they had, like, a, like, circular sled thing, and were sitting down on the circular sled, and then using the tension of the cord to pull them, sled down the hill, and slide across the floodwater, and they would usually make it about 3/4 of the way through the big pool of floodwater before they kind of got stopped and, like, sunk in, depending on how heavy the person was. So I was watching them do this for, like, 10 minutes, and, like, people were going in one after the other, and I was just thinking of how fucking stupid that is in so many different ways. And so here's a lesson for you.
Sean's flash flood warning.
Exactly. So when a flash flood happens, one, while it's going on, stay the fuck inside and get the high ground. and go on the internet, use your cell phone, make sure you're connected to a source that will let you know, like, keep you up to date with what is going on. So if you know that, like, the flash floods are getting really bad where you are, leave, get to higher ground, go to an evacuation center. They'll let you know where the evacuation centers are. Like, that is super fucking important. Two, while the flash flood is going on, do not go, like, obviously don't go into, like, low downhill places. Stay the fuck away from tight places and especially tunnels. Like I said, tunnels is where you're always going to get seriously fucked. And stay the fuck away from any sort of river, creek, any already existing moving body of water is going to be, like, 1,000 times taller and 1,000 times faster than it normally is, and it will kill you literally instantly. Like, if you get hit by a flash flood when you're in a tunnel, you are not going to drown to death. You're going to die from the impact because it's going to snap your fucking neck. So that's, there you go. Flash flood, super fucking dangerous. Like, four people have died, and there are about 100 people unaccounted for right now. So probably there are several more people who have died in this flash flood.
One of the most surreal things today was in attendance. They were like, it is super important we get attendance because we are cross-checking
Yeah, to find out, like, whether these people are dead or not. Like, we need to figure it out. And so, then also, everyone always just assumes that once the raining stops and the flash flood warnings aren't going on, that everything's just safe. But that's not fucking true. So those kids on Friday going down the hill into the floodwater, that's also super fucking stupid. Because you know where that floodwater has been? I fucking don't, and neither do you. That floodwater has been down mountains, gone through city streets. You have no fucking clue what is in that. What is in that could be trees. Fucking just trees could have been dragged down. I mean, trees were dragged down Boulder Creek. Like, there's bound to be glass fucking everywhere in there. Just broken glass, because it's a big surprise in a flash flood in the mountains. That water's going to get tall enough and strong enough to break through windows. And where does the broken glass go? Down the stream with you. So you could very easily, when you're going down that hill, land into that pile of water and get a huge fucking shard of glass right up your ankle. Or, you know, in other more uncomfortable places. And so, yeah, that water is super fucking dangerous. Also, that pool of muddy, disgusting water that had been dragged through mountains, through city streets, through piles of trash, like cigarette butts, like marijuana, because we're in Boulder, it's probably, like, fucking covered in it. Also, they did discover that there is a sewage pipe that along Boulder Creek had been completely burst, so you're also, like, sliding through human filth and urine and stuff like that.
Drowned animals.
Yeah, and that's... And then also, that fucking... like, new lake you have discovered has been sitting there, unmoving, for about 8 hours, and is just a breeding ground for microorganisms. So if you don't get, like, stabbed by glass, or fucking tree, or whatever is going to happen to you when you slide down into this pool of water, you could, if any of the water gets in your mouth or nose, all of a sudden you're dealing with brain-eating amoebas. So, fucking just don't do it. Just stay the fuck away from floodwaters. Just... don't go near it. If the water looks like it's full of shit, it probably is actually full of shit, human or otherwise. So that is my safety warning for everybody. My experience being in the flash flood, just fucking stay away from floodwaters.
The more you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. That's, yeah. So luckily, no one on this podcast was hurt by the flood.
Yeah, all two of us.
Yes.
Because only one of us was actually in the flood, so.
Well, that's true.
So yeah. One of us wasn't even really at risk. Yeah. One of us just sat at home, like, picking his nose all day or whatever you do when I'm not around.
I sat at home watching a movie.
Oh, okay.
This is my transition into
sure.
our next segment.
That's a segue. I'll
okay,
it.
Yeah, okay. So, you may know on this podcast that I love Dragon Ball Z. Sean loves Dragon
yes.
Ball Z.
Yes, I do.
And, you know, I'm a big fan, and earlier this year, in Japan, the new movie, which is the first theatrical feature in 17 years for the Dragon Ball franchise, Dragon Ball Z Battle of Gods, or Kami to Kami in Japanese, which means God and God.
Yeah.
Battle of Gods is a cooler title.
I agree. I mean, I'm sure Kami to Kami plays better in Japanese, like,
right.
with, like, specific cultural
yeah.
senses and stuff like that.
Yeah, but in any case, Battle of Gods came out March 30th. I was super jealous when I was hearing all that, because I was like, ah, that sounds awesome, I would love to see it. Luckily, it came out on Blu-ray in Japan pretty quickly, so it came out last week. Amazon Japan has the friggin' fastest shipping in the world. That came out September 13th in Japan. I had it on September 13th in America.
Jeez.
So it took less than 48 hours to get from Japan to my front door.
Huh.
And I didn't... that is the only shipping option from Amazon Japan to America, is they're super quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. It's kind of expensive, but It's actually no more expensive than anywhere else you would pay for international shipping, obviously. Yeah. $20 is pretty standard. But it's pretty fast. So I got the... They had a couple versions. There's Blu-rays and DVDs, obviously. If they're just tips
Can I get it on VHS?
No.
I'm
sorry.
Tips can I get it on UMD? So I can watch it on my PSP?
Yes. No. Tips for importing, you should know, of course, is that DVDs in Japan are a different region than us. That's region 2. We're region 1. Mm-hmm. Blu-rays are either usually region-free, or we in Japan are the same region, so this will work in any U.S. Blu-ray player.
Because all that shit, that just makes sense naturally, right?
Regions are stupid.
Yeah. Like, of course our Blu-ray region would be the same, but our DVD one wouldn't. Like, obviously, right?
Right, yeah.
They're completely different things.
But anyway, they had a standard Blu-ray version that's one disc. I got the special edition, which was probably about $30 more, but pretty worth it for things I'll walk you through here. First, the box it comes in is awesome. You got this awesome illustration of Super Saiyan God, Son Goku, on the back.
Though I have to admit, I hadn't seen what he looks like, and him just having red hair, that's kind of disappointing.
I like it, and I like it in motion in the movie a lot. I think it looks very, very Toriyama-esque. I mean, he did all the new character designs for the movie, and you can really tell that's Akira Toriyama.
They took the bucket and, in MS Paint, just red.
No, except Goku's also thinner, smaller, looks younger. And again, in motion, you kind of see the logic behind it, I think. But anyway, so the first thing...
It's no Super Saiyan 3 where his hair just gets super fucking long and he loses his eyebrows because all his eyebrows go to his head hair.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's a law of conservation of mass.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, the special edition, first thing it comes with is a wall hanging. It's like a 3D, it's like a figurine in like a picture frame kind of thing.
It's weird. I thought, when you brought it in, I thought it was just an action figure.
Yeah, it's not. It's this wall hanging. You can take this thing off the back and make it just, you can rest it against your desk. Or it's got a nail slot. You can hang it on your wall. I'm just going to put it on my desk. I have another couple little area kind of for picture frames. I'm going to put that there. Right next to the picture of my baby niece. I think it'll be a nice contrast.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it'll look like he's about to kamehameha your niece. Yeah. That's a nice thought, Jonathan.
Well, and then one day when I introduce her to Dragon Ball, I'll be able to say, I used to have Goku's picture right next to yours.
It looked like he was about to disintegrate you with his ki.
Yes. So that's a pretty cool bonus. I like that. My favorite thing in the set, actually, though, is... I don't know, how do I put this thing back on? There we go. Okay. Next physical bonus you get is a set of lobby cards, and these are small versions of the posters for all 17... or 18 now, Dragon Ball movies. Hmm. And they're really cool, because I love Dragon Ball posters. These are really neat. They're the original Japanese ones, so with all the Japanese text and stuff on them, much of which I can read now, because in Japanese class.
Yes.
So it's kind of fun. But anyway, those are pretty cool. You get to go through all those. I like that, because I like those posters a ton. Comes with a really cool book full of... It's got interviews with Toriyama, character guides and stuff. I can't read a lot of this, obviously, but there's a lot of cool pictures and stuff. You know, some concept art, things like that. So, you know, lots of good stuff there. And then finally, the actual disc-based content comes in a pretty nice case. Got the movie's poster on it, which I think is really stylish. I like that poster.
Yeah.
It's got the main movie on a Blu-ray disc. The movie's disc has all the trailers and TV spots and a design art gallery kind of thing. And then there's a bonus DVD. You will need a region-free player if you're ever going to play this. And I do have one just for other purposes, so that was nice. And it's got all these interviews and press conferences and stuff. It's all pretty cool stuff. It also has, and this is the main reason I bought the special edition, the 2008 Jump Super Anime Tour special for Dragon Ball, Yo, Son Goku and Friends Return. I really like that special. It is actually... I like it more than any of the DBZ movies. I think it's fantastic. It's so much fun. It's hilarious. It's very true to the spirit of the series, which, you know, is an action-heavy series, but is also very comical, very character-focused. And so that's that. If you've never seen that special, it's really good. You can find it online pretty easily, too. Mm-hmm. But anyway, as for the actual movie, I want to talk about a little. The Blu-ray does not contain English subtitles, because this is not an American release.
Yes.
You shouldn't expect it to. But, you know, I was able to follow it. One, because I'm familiar with some of the words they use in Dragon Ball.
Yes. When he was like, Kamehameha!
I knew exactly
what was going on. You
didn't think
he was, talking about ramen or something?
No.
Okay,
but,
that's good.
But also, if you've ever been to the fan site Kanzenshu, it's a Dragon Ball fan site, super comprehensive. I love going there. If you want to know anything about the world of Dragon Ball, they've got it all. It's super good information. They've got, you know,
super good information. Super not good. Just good information. Super good.
Super reliable is the word
It's got like golden hair. That's how good the information is.
Yes.
It's super good.
But anyway, and, you know, they've got one of their contributors is in Japan, speaks Japanese. You know, they've got people who, you know, can really dive into the series. And they have a full detailed synopsis of the movie from back in March that was there to share with fans who weren't in the region to see the movie. And it's such a detailed blow-by-blow subscription. Most of the dialogue is even written out for you. So I just kind of had that on my phone. I probably paused the movie every 20 minutes, read the next 20 minutes, and then watched it and was fine that way. I'd love to see it subtitled sometimes just to make sure I get every joke. But even without that, you know, I was able to laugh at it. It's very funny. The action's still exciting and stuff. But in terms of actual review of the movie,
yes,
it's really good. It's not great.
Okay.
I'll say, I guess I was really hyped for this, and I was slightly disappointed. My biggest problem with it is that while it is a full 90-minute feature film, looks theatrical, all of that, it still kind of has, it doesn't necessarily have theatrical pacing. It doesn't have the problem a lot of DBZ movies have where it's just relentless action.
Yeah.
It's actually very much the other way. There's very little action in the movie. And what there is there is the best in the whole series in terms of the movies, at least. It's fantastic. It's just unbelievable. But really, it's very story-heavy, character-heavy. It's got a fairly intricate story in some ways and some really good character work. I mean, there really is an arc for Goku in this movie that's really interesting. Some good character study and stuff. But the one thing I think that's a problem, and this wouldn't be fixed by more action necessarily, that's not what I'm asking for, it's just pace-wise, there's very little momentum to it. Sort of the story is there's this god of destruction named Beerus, who is a phenomenal villain, he's awesome, because he's not really evil, he's got a role to fulfill, and, you know, he wants to see what the Super Saiyan god is like, you know, all the Saiyans are giving him guff, at one point he just wants to destroy the Earth, and, you know, who can blame him?
Yeah, he's the god of destruction.
Yeah, like, it's his job.
What the fuck else is he supposed to do but destroy shit, right?
Right. You know, he wants to destroy stuff and have a good fight. So he and Goku, you know, they're a good match that way. But anyway, so
because yeah, Goku just goes around just maniacally destroying stuff all the time.
No, he likes having fights. That's
oh,
what I'm saying.
Oh, that's what you meant. Okay.
No. But anyway, so it's a lot of sort of Beerus comes to Bulma's birthday party is kind of the main center of the movie, and there's a lot of he's thinking about destroying the Earth. Vegeta and some other people are trying to convince him not to. He really just wants to see this mythical Super Saiyan God form. They're trying to figure out what that is. So it's very sort of low-key. Even when the fights do start, it's less like the fate of the Earth is at stake, though it sort of is, than Beerus really wants to see this mythical power, Goku really wants to achieve it, and when they do, I think there's a line about this, it's more like a training session than a fight. Like, they really kind of want to see each other's power. And even then, they never really make any bones about it. This is not a fight Goku can win. That's never on the table. This villain is so far beyond. It's really about Goku kind of being humbled through this. So it's really interesting in those ways. But it just means the pacing is sort of slow isn't even the right word. There just isn't momentum or urgency
to it. Like that plot synopsis sounds like it would work a lot better as an arc in like the TV show than it would as a movie. Because it's like it has that whole like in a movie you want the stakes to be really big most of the time, especially if it's something like Dragon Ball Z. You want like, oh shit, like everything's gonna blow up if it's the movie version, right?
Yeah, and I'll say I think it's interesting and I appreciate what they're going for here because this is something very different for the franchise, and that's really nice to see. It's just, you get to the hour mark, and things are starting to heat up battle-wise, but it's not like this is something we've been building to. It's like more like this is the next step in the plot, sort of. So there's just very little urgency to it, and that being said, it's really well done. It's very, very funny. They've got all the characters just down pat. Toriyama, the author of the manga, worked very closely with them on this. And his hand is just visible everywhere in the storytelling. And I know one of the things, this is sort of speaking of floods and stuff, Japan experienced a horrible, devastating tsunami a couple of years ago, 2011. And the Battle of Gods, their original plan for it before they brought Toriyama on board was, I guess, much bigger in a certain sense. And he very specifically wanted to tell a more lighthearted story, something fun, something that spoke to the characters but wasn't filled with scenes of destruction and stuff. He wanted it for the Japanese people to be something more escapist while still being true to the series. And I think it works really well in that sense, if you understand kind of what they were going for in that way, because it's very funny. You get all your favorite characters back together, a really fun sort of reunion with them. It's kind of like the 2008 special in that regard, and I think the special is more successful that way because it's only 25 minutes, and every second of it is used to just the maximum potential. But this is really fun and funny, too. The new villain, Beerus, he's just a great villain. He's just a great character. Because, again, I think the dynamic of him not being evil is fascinating. Because most Dragon Ball Z villains are over-the-top evil.
And Yes, that is true.
And
yes.
that's the fun in them. And sometimes there are great villains in the series because of that. But, you know, this is really fun because, you know, Beerus, he's the God of Destruction. That's his role. He's not malicious towards Earth.
Yeah.
And even then, the things that he's also kind of a very playful character. He's very funny. His character design is sort of, you know, you look at him on the cover, he looks kind of like Anubis, the Egyptian god. But they really play up the cat-like side to him and stuff, and that's really interesting to me in his movements and whatnot. I really like the way he fights and just the way he talks. He's got a great voice actor, all this stuff. But, I mean, there's just some great jokes with him. Like, what sets him off when he ultimately decides it's time to destroy Earth is Majin Buu, who is good at this point in the series, won't share his pudding. And it is one of the greatest comic set pieces in all of Dragon Ball history. It is so great. And there's so many other great jokes here. Like, Vegeta has to do a song and dance about Bingo to placate Beerus.
Of course, like logically.
Yeah, yes. Logically.
And that is like one of the first things you do when you encounter a God of Destruction, is you do song and dance about Bingo.
Yes. Yeah. Emperor Pilaf from the very beginning of Dragon Ball has a small part in this that's really funny.
Does he make a wish to make Goku a kid?
No, he is a kid in this, actually. He had made himself younger by accident.
Huh.
It's kind of ironic.
That's weird.
Yeah. Does
he go on a quest through space to find, like, evil Dragon Balls or some bullshit like that?
No. Again, this Toriyama had something to do with this. He had very little to do with GT.
Yeah.
As is abundantly clear when you watch Dragon Ball GT. Let's see. There's a great set piece with Gohan, who, teen Gohan from his high school years. I guess he's an adult now because he's married to Videl. But he's always a really funny character as an adult, and he's got this, there's this thing with Gohan that happens here that is so fucking funny, and you realize he's inherited his father's skill for being a terrible husband.
Does he slap Videl or something? What happens?
Videl gets shot because of him.
Yeah, okay.
And it's of course not fatally, and, you know, she takes it in stride, but there's a great scene where what happens...
she takes it in stride. It's fine. She just got shot. It's no big deal.
But what's the funniest part? The funniest part of it, though, is then Chi Chi gives him this speech about what a horrible husband he is, and Gohan's reaction is very funny. But I mean, those character dynamics are perfect. There's some great Mr. Satan is not in it a ton, but he has two jokes in particular that are just dynamite. It's character wise, it couldn't be better. The stuff with Goku is legitimately interesting in the end, where it really speaks to sort of his personal philosophy on fighting and stuff that we've seen a lot in the series. How he's all about self-betterment. But really how it manifests itself here, I think, is really interesting by the end. What they do with Beerus. There's some scenes at the end that I love. For instance, after the fight, there's this scene that the animation in it is just spectacular, where Goku and Beerus kind of just talk. And there's this piano piece over it that's actually really gorgeous. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the history of the series. It's a really great scene that I think kind of sums up Goku in a lot of ways. So I think it's a very good Dragon Ball Z movie. I would put it above a lot of the Dragon Ball Z movies because a lot of them are...
Is it better than Bio Broly?
Yes.
The greatest of all Dragon Ball Z movies?
Yes. In movie 11, not their finest hour. Not their finest hour. But, you know, that one's got some fun things in it. But, you know, most of the Dragon Ball movies, I feel like you have to grade on a very severe curve. Like, you grade it by Dragon Ball movie standards.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Mostly Battle of Gods, I think you can just look at as a good movie. It's a good movie. And I don't think it's as good as specifically movie 13, which is, I think, called Wrath of the Dragon over here. But that's the one where Trunks makes this friend who has kind of been a... I don't know if he's come... I forget if he's come through time or something. But
it's like time and space because he's kind of like an alien dude with Moloch.
Movie 13 to me is one that I never have to look at on any sort of curve. I just think it's a really good movie. It's a short film, obviously. It's like 45 minutes. Yeah. But it's a really good... It's got some great action, but it's also a good character piece for Trunks. It's got some interesting dynamics to it. I think that's just a really good one. And I don't like this one as much as that, and I would put it on par with maybe some of the other ones that I like for more purely aesthetic reasons or you know, just for fun and stuff, like movie 12, the Fusion one. There's some great stuff in that. But this is really good. The animation is great, although it's very heavily digital, as most anime is these days.
Yeah.
And... I don't like the animation as much as old-style Dragon Ball animation, because I really like the very handcrafted style of Dragon Ball from the 80s and 90s, but, you know, it's very good. And as I said, the action scenes, there's probably only, you know, 10 combined minutes of fighting in this movie, but good God, is it phenomenal. And there's just a sense of sort of weight and scale to it without ever showing scenes of mass destruction, which I think is really impressive, that is really, really tremendous. So it's a fun movie. And,
cool,
you know, if you feel comfortable watching it without subtitles, import the Blu-ray. It'll only cost you $82.
Yeah, or you can just wait.
Yeah. Although, who knows if it'll actually come out over here. It's...
Oh, fuck, you want to wait, like, just wait until someone puts it online with fan subs. You know?
That's probably
like,
true, yeah.
You don't need to wait till it gets, like, localized in English to see it.
And I actually think I checked. There probably are fan subs online, and I think I saw some. I wanted to buy the movie and not pirate it, but that was just my opinion. But I might now that I physically legally own the movie, I might check out one of those fan subs and see if they're decent or not. But it's a really, if you're wondering why Funimation, the owner of Dragon Ball in the United States, hasn't said anything about it yet, it's because 20th Century Fox sort of didn't co-produce the movie, but they helped fund it because they did that shitty live-action Dragon Ball movie.
Dragon Ball Evolution, yes.
Yeah.
The best Dragon Ball movie. Everyone knows that, right?
Fucking terrible.
It's
just
amazing.
But because they made that, they have first dibs on movie rights in North America, and I guess there's some international things there too, so they kind of co-funded this movie. Their logo, if you watch the movie, the 20th Century Fox logo is at the beginning, which is super weird.
That's awesome.
But, yeah. And so they own it, and I can't imagine they have any interest in putting it out over here. I imagine if they did, they'd probably have said something about it by now. It's been 6-7 months. What I think will probably happen is a couple years will pass, and the rights will become more open, and then Funimation will probably try to get it. Funimation has said they would like to do it very much. And
yeah, of course they would.
They've tried to get it. And as we know, Funimation, like with Dragon Ball Kai, they had that out here less than a year after its premiere. So they've been on board on those things, what they can get, what's available to them. This is not available to them, and I don't know if it ever will be, so... It's that's really up in the air right now, which is too bad because I think Funimation could make this very successful over here.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we will see. Although there are definitely some parts where, because it is so key to some of the original Toriyama stuff, I wonder how they would handle it in dubbing. But that would be an interesting thing to see. So, So that's that. That's obscure movie talk of the week.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I want to talk about movies on this podcast. There's nothing really out right now that we would talk about that might appeal to our podcast audience.
Yeah.
So this is as good as I can do, damn it. Talking about Dragon Ball.
All right, then.
All right. Sean, you want to talk a little Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, let's move into the topic of the hour.
Okay. So do you want to start by just, like, what are your plans for Grand Theft Auto 5?
I'm going to wait till it gets here because I have it pre-ordered on Amazon, and then I'm going to play it.
Okay. Nice.
What about you?
I had it pre-ordered on Amazon, and then they announced on the Rockstar Twitter channel, and it was picked up by all the news outlets, that you would be able to preload it through PSN today, and so I canceled my physical pre-order because I just have a situation where I'm not even going to get home on the day it comes out until like 10 p.m., so if I could preload it, that would be fucking awesome. But then, after I had pre-ordered the digital version, Sony came out and said, we will actually not be doing a preload.
Yeah, it's going to be on the same day, right? You have to download it at like midnight or something.
Yeah, which actually is still better for me because that's 10 p.m. our time tonight, the night we're recording this podcast. I'm just going to get it started, and then by the time I get home, it will be long since downloaded, and it'll install automatically. And that'll be better than having the disc because I would still have to sit through the install process. It'll do it all on its own digitally. So I also kind of was interested in testing out the digital process with this game because I've kind of decided I'm going to go all digital for PS4 and beyond. So I like that idea. I also like the idea of GTA 5 being on my PS3 at all times in case I sit down and the disc.
It's
I don't
like
want
my
it in
my
there.
Cartridge of Persona 4 the Golden in my Vita. It's,
yeah,
it's always there no matter what happens.
Yeah. So anyway, those are my plans for GTA 5. I cannot wait.
Okay. Yeah. So we're both going to
play
GTA 5.
Explain why are you excited for GTA 5?
Because I've liked every Grand Theft Auto game I played, and they were all really good. And I've liked every Rockstar game I played, which
is
most
more
of the modern ones.
Yeah.
And so, I have... And actually, reviews are out today, and I've glanced at a few of them, and it's getting, as expected, like a bunch of 5-star, 10 out of 10 reviews.
Yeah.
Although the best review I've seen is weird. It's kind of like with Last of Us. The best review I've seen is technically in terms of like what they place the score. The worst review was like with Last of Us. The Polygon review was like the most glowing review of the game because the dude was like, "I can barely even play this game because it's so harrowing and so depressing and it's just not fun because it's so brutal. I can't. I have to pause like every 20 minutes and I can't just keep playing the game." And so that was like, this game sounds fucking amazing if it can have that kind of reaction in someone. So the Polygon review for Last of Us was great. And this one is the Escapist Review, which gave it like 3.5 out of 5 stars, which is by far the lowest I've seen. Like, nothing's gone below like 9 out of 10s. And in this one, the dude, like, half the review is him talking about how you don't play as anti-heroes in this game. Like, all the three main characters are just scumbags, and they're just horrible people, and all the stuff. And he goes on and on about that, and I'm just like, this sounds awesome! This game sounds great! Like, he doesn't like playing this game, in a way. And it's like, happy, but in a way that makes it sound a lot more mature. Like, almost the way you would describe watching a movie that might make you incredibly uncomfortable, but well, it's like you still recognize how good of a movie it is.
Well, for instance, one of my problems with GTA 4, that we'll talk about that game in a minute, mm-hmm. is that I felt like they never committed to Niko Bellic enough to me in one way or another, and I kind of like the idea that, and I've heard this has been a theme across the GTA 5 reviews, that these are not likable characters.
Yeah, that they're fucking, and they're scumbags.
I like the idea of Rockstar just going whole hog on something like that, because mm-hmm. when, I think that their post-GTA 4 games, I think they've had a clearer grasp of character, and they've really gone deeper in on that.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of bringing that back to GTA 5, but, yeah. So what were you saying about that review? Just that it's
it's the worst score review, but the way they describe the game makes it sound awesome and like in a really cool way that makes it sound different, that makes it sound more mature than games have been before.
Yeah, yeah, I've read a couple reviews. I know I've read Joystick, Polygon, and IGN's. IGN had a video review. I just watched that this morning while I was getting ready to leave. But yeah, it's interesting. Like, definitely it sounds like they've, a lot of stuff we've wanted, like just the total refined GTA experience is there. I'm interested to see. I've seen a lot of varied reaction to the story, which makes me more curious than ever to see what my reaction's going to be to it.
Yeah, like most of that stuff, I've like when I say like I looked at reviews, I really skimmed it and like looked at the score. The Escapist one was the only one I paid any real attention to because it was like this interesting outlier in the review scores.
Yeah, but I just want my hands on it. But let's talk about our history with the GTA series and maybe a little bit about Rockstar, because I think is this accurate to say for both you and me, GTA 5 excites us less because it's GTA than because it's Rockstar.
Yeah, definitely, because, you know, the last GTA game was made in 2008, was when mm-hmm. GTA 4 came out, and Rockstar has since made Red Dead Redemption, Max Payne 3, I think that might be the only...
L.A. Noire.
Oh yeah, and L.A. Noire. Well, like they didn't develop L.A. Noire, they published it. Team Blondie developed L.A. Noire. So
I know is that when I bought GTA 5 on PSN, I got L.A. Noire for 75% off.
Great.
I got the complete edition for $10. Nice. That's like 25 gigs of stuff.
Yeah.
Because the main game is 15 gigs, and then there's just DLC up the ass for that game. There's so much.
Yeah, it's really good DLC, too. L.A. Noire is a great fucking game.
I'm excited to
play. But it's not a Rockstar game, really.
Okay.
But yeah, so... Yeah, like, definitely, I think Rockstar is definitely one of the best developers, and it's a really interesting developer, more than anything else, that, like, nobody, it's kind of like Valve. Nobody makes a game like Valve makes a game, and nobody makes a game like how Rockstar makes a game. It's just completely unique.
Yeah.
And so, you always have to, like, wait, like, 2 to 3 years to get another Rockstar game. So, let's... I was going to start with you.
Okay, what did you want to ask me?
Well, I was going to ask you what you were going to ask me. Where did you start? Where did your history with Rockstar or Grand Theft Auto begin?
I think it was GTA 4. And I've been running this through to my head. I've played some San Andreas, which obviously came out before GTA 4. Yes. But I believe I played it on the Xbox 360 as an Xbox mm-hmm. One classic. And I know that came out after GTA 4. Because they didn't even have Xbox One Classics, I think, by the time that came out. That was very early into the...
Xbox One Classics aren't happening until, like, 10 years from now. What are you talking about? Original Xbox Classics? OG Xbox?
What did they call it? Was that what they were called?
I don't remember what they, like, specifically called them. Like, it's just the original Xbox games available digitally on the Xbox 360 marketplace.
This is why I hate this Xbox One bullshit.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, too.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think it was GTA 4, and I think... I honestly did not have... Just, like... Grand Theft Auto, I was, like, for instance, not a huge PS2 gamer during the PS2 era, so I didn't have, and also I was too young to be playing Grand Theft Auto, you know, when the PS2 was out for a lot of the time.
Sure.
And so I just didn't have a lot of experience, like, I didn't know about that franchise much, but Grand Theft Auto 4 came out, and of course, that is one of the most successful entertainment products of all time.
Yeah.
And actually, it was my older brother was living with us at the time. He was my half-brother, so he did not live with us most of my life. But he was living with us for that year. And I know he got Grand Theft Auto 4 and was using our Xbox. And I started playing it. My parents didn't know. They did not want me to play it at the time for whatever reason. I wasn't that young or anything. That was like, we were probably 15 or something? 14 or 15? Yeah. So, but anyway, started playing Grand Theft Auto 4. And while I have problems with Grand Theft Auto 4 that I've been vocal about in the past, that really was a huge eye-opening experience. Grand Theft Auto 4 was, like, playing that kind of rewired a lot of my understandings of what gaming could be. Because I'd done some kind of open-world-esque stuff before, yeah. but no one does open-world like Rockstar does open-world. And especially GTA 4 was just them kind of blowing the hinges off, because this was their new first next-gen game. And yeah, I think I really was just taken in by that, to see how one had that kind of peak of how sort of brutal video games could be in some ways, but also how smart in other ways, character-driven, the specific use of cutscenes, which it still bothers me in Rockstar games sometimes for reasons I'll talk about later, but still I think it's really fascinating how, you know, story and character-heavy those are, while having this just tremendous gameplay hook of all the different things you can do. And Grand Theft Auto 4 is just, that's one of those games that since I started playing it in 2008, I have played off and on ever since. And gone back to, usually just to kind of fool around in, but but always kind of been there. And then I've dabbled with Grand Theft Auto San Andreas and some, although it's really, really tough to go back to a previous GTA title once you've played the newest one. I also played Grand Theft Auto Chinatown Wars on the DS. Didn't finish it. It's a really good game, though. You should try it out if you never have. And then, obviously, with Rockstar games after that, really where I fell in love with Rockstar was Red Dead Redemption. If you remember our top 10 games of all time list, it was on my list. I don't remember how high.
Yeah.
But Red Dead, just one of the most awesome things ever. And I love with Rockstar what a clear evolution all their games are from one to the next, even when they're in totally different, you know, series. And you could feel how GTA 4 provided a foundation for Red Dead, and then Red Dead just took it to the nth degree. And it was, I mean, even we're talking, you know, GTA 5, one of the things that's going to be fascinating is that it is on the same hardware as GTA 4. But I think Red Dead and GTA 4 being on the same hardware is amazing. Definitely. It's just amazing that you would make those two games one generation, because one feels to me vastly more mature than the other, both narratively and gameplay-wise.
Yeah, like, definitely with, in like, just in terms of, like, the graphics in Red Dead Redemption, how much, like, clearly they matured the engine and stuff, it was really impressive.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so anyways, so is that, because you never played Max Payne 3, did you?
No.
Okay, so Red Dead was your last, although it makes sense why Red Dead was your last Rockstar game, because it did take you like 2 years to play.
Well, and I'll say, I'm familiar with Max Payne, I'm familiar with L.A. Noire and stuff, so I kind of still know the arc of Rockstar, like I just haven't played
L.A.
those.
Noire. Not really
okay,
a Rockstar
sorry,
game.
Sorry.
Stop counting it, goddamn.
Yeah. Okay, so what were we going to say?
I think now, I have not started down my own
good.
Personal history with Rockstar games, because I've played quite a bit more of them than you have. So for me, where it started for me was I rented Grand Theft Auto San Andreas on the original Xbox, not the Xbox One. The original Xbox, probably like 2005, I don't remember when San Andreas came out. I played it a bit then. Like, I don't think I got super far into it, because a lot of the... Like, San Andreas is a tough game, but not because, like, it's challenging in a fair way. It's just there's a lot of bullshit shit about San Andreas. You know, it's an older game, so it's just a lot of the mission design kind of just is really bad in a lot of places, and, like, requires really specific stuff that is not easy to do because it doesn't control great in a lot of situations. So I never beat San Andreas when it originally came out. Then, before GTA 4 came out in 2008, I got San Andreas on the original Xbox Classics, or whatever the fuck, OG Xbox.
Yeah.
Cool shit. Whatever the fuck that service was called. Then I got that, and then I finished San Andreas on that one, because by then I was a lot better at video games and could deal with the bullshit that is in San Andreas. And I really, really like San Andreas. I think it's a really good game. It's obviously flawed in the way that all those older, like, open-world third-person games are, and that, like, the shooting is fucking terrible. It's like, in San Andreas, like, lock on is the right trigger and shoot is the left trigger.
What the fuck?
Yeah, that's super fucking dumb. And San Andreas is a really, really long game, and like half the world is just completely barren because it takes place all over San Andreas, which is a state. So there are like three main cities that are all separated by like huge stretches of just like fucking nothing, and that's a really like troubling part about the game. But the story is really fun, the writing is clever, the voice acting is really good. Samuel L. Jackson plays the main villain in the game, Officer Tenpenny, and yeah, that's fucking awesome. And San Andreas is a really, really fun game. And then after I played San Andreas, I don't know if this is after GTA 4 had come out or not, but at some point I got in like Xbox, like a double pack where they had released GTA 3 and Vice City on the original Xbox and like released them both together. And I got that off of Amazon for probably like $20 whenever I got that. And then tried to play those games. GTA 3 was completely impossible for me to play. It was way too old. It just wasn't fun at all for me. It was so old. But it was interesting just as, oh, this is like the first example of a third-person open world game ever. Like, or just basically open world game ever of all time. So it's like, of course, it's really hard to go back and play it because it's the original one. But it is interesting to see where the tropes kind of come from. Then Vice City was a little bit easier. It still controls like complete fucking shit. It is so hard to play. The mission design is absolutely terrible. I know like a lot of people say that Vice City is their favorite one because it does have a great setting. And the soundtrack is awesome because it's set in the 80s. It has very like Scarface, Miami Vice kind of vibe to it. And that part of it is cool, but as a game, it's terrible. Like, if you try to approach it from, like, a modern perspective, the mission design is just so bad. The missions are no fun to play. The shooting is just terrible. The driving's not... The driving is serviceable. Like, you can drive around, but it's not interesting because there's not a lot of, like, weight to the cars or anything. So Vice City, to me, was really hard to play. So it's like I dabbled with both of those for a couple of hours, but never really got deep into them. So for me, like, it was really... I had beaten San Andreas. I really liked San Andreas. And then in 2008, GTA 4 came out, and I fucking love GTA 4. I think it is a great, great game. It definitely has its problems, but I think I am, like... But a lot of people have a lot more of a problem with GTA 4, and I know you do than I do. Like, I think...
I think it's a great game.
Yeah,
I
know, but you,
that,
like,
yeah.
Like, you take a lot more issue with some of the problems that GTA 4 has, whereas I am now and always will be a staunch defender of GTA 4. I think GTA 4 is fucking amazing. I think it's a landmark game. I think is immensely important. I think it does great fucking things. So I love GTA 4. I've beaten GTA 4 twice. You know, I played the DLC, the Lost and Damned and Ballad of Gay Tony, and both of those are fucking awesome. But I love GTA 4 to death. Then after that, obviously, was Red Dead Redemption. Also, fucking amazing game. Red Dead, like, that was also on my top 10 list. I think, it, like you said, it shows a maturation in what Rockstar was trying to do in terms of, like, it definitely, like, it handles the protagonist a lot better than it did with Nico Bellic. It, like handles the mature story style instead of the silly story style that, like, the GTA 3 games were. And it does that a lot better than GTA 4 did. And then just plays a lot better, and the setting is a lot more interesting to me. So I love Red Dead Redemption. And then also I think Max Payne 3, I played that. And Max Payne 3 is one of my favorite third-person shooters of all time because Max Payne 3 is really hard, but it's really fair in how hard it is, and just like the shooting is really satisfying and really difficult, and you have to use a lot of strategy, and there's a lot of motion involved because it has that sort of like John Woo style, like diving and slow motion and shooting people. That's a lot of fun. And its only major problem is that it has a shit ton of cutscenes, where the cutscenes are really good, and I really actually liked it. The cutscenes and all that the first time I played it, but it makes replays really fucking annoying because you can't skip through most of them because they load behind the cutscenes, so that's pretty frustrating. But then other than that, I fucking love Max Payne 3, and even though L.A. Noire doesn't count, L.A. Noire is also a fucking great game, too.
I know that was your best game of the year whenever it came out.
Yeah, L.A. Noire is a fantastic game. That it also, like, really specifically plays to some of my interests, so that's one of the reasons why I love it so much, So, yeah, I've loved, like, every single Rockstar developed and published game I've played, other than their, like, really old games that are the only reason why I can't play GTA 3 and Vice City, obviously, is just because they're too old. It's not that it's not like I'm saying they were terrible when they came out. It's just, like, trying to go back to them is fucking impossible.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's kind of funny. GTA 3 came out on the iPad last year, and when it came out, it was 99 cents, so I'm like, why the hell not?
I can tell you why the hell
not. I played 5 minutes of it, and I'm like, here's why the hell not, because, A, you can't control a console game with a touchscreen. It doesn't matter what the console game is.
Yeah, that's
does
true.
Not
yeah.
matter. Doesn't work. All the iPhone gaming shit is stupid, unless it's stuff like Doodle Jump or Tetris or something.
Yeah.
Even Tetris does not control well on an iPhone. But in any case, but I started, it's kind of funny because they had just all the controls are down in the right-hand corner of the screen, and it was bad. Even beyond what GTA 3 would be if you were playing it with an actual proper controller, you know? But anyway, so that's my experience with GTA 3.
yeah. So it's a hard enough game to control and play on it. So in its original format, I can't even imagine using a touchscreen would be
right.
horrendous.
But let's talk GTA 4.
Okay.
While we're on that, if this is the first one that we've both played.
Yeah. And obviously, like, it's the first one of, like, the modern Rockstar style. Like, there's a clear delineation between the GTA 3, like, the PS2 games, and then GTA 4 onwards, because those ones, like San Andreas and stuff, just completely ridiculous. Like, you get a fucking jetpack, you, like, fight. I don't think you actually fight aliens, but you go to Area 51 over the course of San Andreas. It's a crazy fucking game. San Andreas is just so bizarre.
I remember when you finished it, I think we were at lunch or something in high school, and you told
me
the story.
And I told you the ending, like the whole ending of the game.
That was entertaining, just to hear what the
story
was.
Yeah, the ending of the game where it's like, spoilers for San Andreas, whether they came out in like 2005. It's like, even if you play it now, you're never going to get to that's a long, long fucking game, San Andreas. But it's like the end of that game is like you go back to the original city, because it's like you were a gang member and one of the guys in your gang, Grove Street, Big Smoke, betrayed you, sold you out to Tenpenny and the Man, and so then you get kicked out of Los Santos, and then you go around all over San Andreas, and then come back to Los Santos as the prodigal son, and then it's like, oh shit, like LA, the riots start because Big Smoke has gotten all this money, and he has this huge fucking mansion now, and so you go back, you start riots against Tenpenny, and then you get into the mansion, then you ascend, 50 floors, and it's just constant combat. It's a terrible mission, but it's like, you just kill everybody, you get to the top, you fucking kill Big Smoke, and then you get outside, and then you fight Tenpenny, and I think you get on, the back of a fucking fire truck, and you're, fighting him that way. It's fucking ridiculous. It's an insane game. And then, obviously, then GTA 4 came out, and they decided... And this is the big split where, like, either people really like this, I really like it, or people really hate it, and it is that GTA 4 is much more serious. That ultimately its story is serious. Like, it definitely has, like, a lot of satirical elements, like every Rockstar game has, and it has its very silly moments, but they're a lot more grounded in how silly they are. And then the ultimate story is really fucking depressing when you get down to it.
And I should say, that's one of the things I love most about GTA 4. Mm-hmm. The seriousness has never bothered me. In fact, some of the sillier stuff bothers me. Some of the stuff that I feel isn't integrated as well. But I think the seriousness of GTA 4 is... I mean, there's weight to that story, and it works very well in that way, for the most part, for me.
I agree.
But anyway, what were you going to say?
I don't know. I was done saying what I was saying.
Oh, okay.
I was waiting for you to say something.
I like GTA 4.
So do I. Okay, is the podcast over?
Okay. No, but it's a darn good game. It's I mean, why don't... You know, you are more passionate about this game, so why don't you tell us about it? Like, what makes it work so well?
What I like about it? Well, I think that the serious storytelling is definitely one of the things that is best about it. And I think the serious storytelling of it, I think, reflects... And I think all of, what I love about GTA 4 is that it is a time capsule. Like, it perfectly replicates the period it is set in and the place it's set in, being America. And that, you know, like, GTA has always had a very sort of, like, satirical approach to America. And if you, like, want to look at it that way, it's almost anti-American. And that, like, it's heavily critical of a lot of stuff that America does. And that was really hard to take seriously when you're in a game that also you fucking CJ is flying around in a jetpack and you're like, what the fuck? I started out as like this 2-bit dude riding a bicycle getting like chased by the cops because I'm a black guy and just cops will chase you because you're a black guy and I'm in LA. And then now I'm fighting fucking aliens with a jetpack and bullshit. Like, that's crazy. It's still hard to take the setback.
And your
seriously.
Dildo weapon.
Yeah, exactly. And then whereas GTA 4, it's like, by the time you got to GTA 4, you know, it's like, I think... You're looking at a like the post 9/11 world. Like obviously all of them, like GTA 3 came out right after 9/11 did. But like at that point in time, like I think the silliness was almost like kind of like the Battle of Gods. It was a form of escapism. And that is like, it's so silly. You don't take any of this crime and killing seriously. It's just crazy and over the top. But then by the time GTA 4 comes out, we are far enough away from the war on terror type, like, you know, like the George Bush administration, the whole, just all that stuff. We're far enough away from it. It's far enough away from 9/11. To be really serious about it again and, like, really look at it. And the medium has gotten to this point, the technology has gotten to the point where you can take a serious eye and look at what American society is like, what 9/11 did, and how paranoid we are. And I think GTA 4 replicates that really well. Just, like, small touches, like, the reason how they gate off, you know, the starting area so that you don't go end up exploring, like, the whole map. So to keep you focused, that all these games have, is that... like they just have closed off all the bridges because everyone's afraid of terrorist attacks, even though there's no evidence of there ever going to be a terrorist attack. They're just like, terrorists, like, we're cutting off the bridges. Like, that just small detail, that little bit of thought put into that, just like, I think it really sort of grounds it and sets you in this post 9/11 but serious post 9/11, very critical post 9/11 world. And that's like, that's what I really love about GTA 4 is that all just the stuff like the fucking cell phone being the hub, where like that point in time, and it's like, and it's interesting going back to it because it's like right before smartphones started happening. So it's like, it puts you right in this, you have like your flip phone, and the phone doesn't do everything, but it is this one thing that keeps you connected to the world. But it does give you like this like bit of distance where you don't like have a web browser on your phone and all that shit. Like your phone's not going to play all your music for you. So it's like it's such a great time capsule of the place it was set in, the time it was set in, the technology that was rampant. And I think it's a, just the world around it, not even necessarily the main story, is a fantastic piece of satire and a look on American culture. And that's why I love it. It's just like, it's not so silly. It's not so over the top that you can look at it and take it seriously and like make you think about stuff like growing up and living in this time, that makes you look at it very seriously and think about some of the shit that's actually going on.
And I agree with all of that, absolutely. And I think that, you know, from a story standpoint, Grand Theft Auto 4 is basically one very long repudiation of the idea of the American dream.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, having it be Niko Bellic, a foreigner who comes from this, like, civil war over in Serbia, and then, like, coming over here, like, seeking this, like, American dream, and then finding just, like, shit everywhere, and rampant paranoia, and then, like, this excess that nobody knows how to deal with, like, that comes from crime. All that shit's fucking great.
Yeah, and I think all the scenes with him and Roman talking, and their, you know, Roman, who just is so set in the idea of the American dream, even though he has no evidence of it, really.
Yeah, he has nothing.
Yeah, he has this cab company, sort of, but he's always getting threatened by gangsters and stuff, because that's, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, messages of the game, is really these criminal subcultures that are, for not just immigrants, but a lot of people who aspire to that kind of dream, that's what really governs them, is these criminal subcultures and things like that.
And then also, like, it's just like, there's always, one thing about the game I like is that it's just like, so much of it is you have this sense of bureaucracy, because you're constantly, like, Nico's kind of like crawling his way to the top, doing all these odd jobs for all these different crime families that then like point him to someone else. So it's like you start out with like this really low level Russian mob, and then eventually you kind of like with these Italian mobsters that are doing like bank heists. Then you start moving, like, you're working with like I can't remember, like, the black guy's name, who has like the huge mansion and all that stuff, and he has like his old gang member that he's like disenfranchised and all this bullshit. Like,
I love that part of the game.
Yeah, like, it's, I like how you're like moving up these levels of sort of like criminal bureaucracy, but there's always like another dude who's higher. It's like you never get to the top. I like that's, again, like, it's a nice look at sort of American society of like, we have created like all these like middle management jobs that it's like there's always someone higher. It's like you never are talking to the top man. It's just like, you're always fucking like, just tell me who's in charge, and like, nobody's in charge. It's all just fucking out of control, because nobody owns any of this shit.
Right, and I think GTA 4 has a perfect ending. Yeah. Where the ending, it's a really great use of the, like, dual ending structure.
Yeah.
Because the entire dual, you know, and if you're like me or Sean, you went back and played both endings, obviously, and saw them both, and they're, you know, similar in many ways, but the idea is that either way you're fucked, because sort of the system you're in is fucked.
Yeah.
And either way, it's ending with Niko just pretty much broken.
Yeah.
And no matter, you know, there just is no good ending there. There isn't a good ending or bad ending. There's a bad and bad ending, you know? And I think that's really interesting. Lots, like, you know, it's thematically and intellectually, it's really smart.
Yeah. Yeah. And it definitely, like, because we both have gone back and been like I would load it up Ballad of Gay Tony just because it has a lot more stuff in it. And it's just like, it's just a better version of the game because it came out a year later. Yeah. But it's like, we've both been sort of just like messing around in it just to sort of like catch up on it since GTA 5's coming out, and it definitely just like, I don't know, like, it takes me, like I said, it's like a time capsule, like it just takes me back to that period of time because it so perfectly replicates it. Just like all the shit with the phone, all that stuff, it's like the people running around, the billboards, the shit on the radio, it's just such a perfect version of 2008 America that's like, it's so cool because you're there, and it's like kind of like allows you to remember this really weird version of that time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. What should we talk about next with GTA 4?
Like, I want to hear...
Do you want to hear my problems with it?
Yeah, exactly. You're a lot more critical of the game, and I'm aware of the criticisms, but I want to hear you voice them. What are your problems with it?
First thing I'll say while we're talking about the story is I have always... And these are all criticisms that I had at the time and continue to have. These are not things I got in retrospect. The game's too long. I think the game's way too fucking long. Maybe not way too long, but I think it is too long. I think there's a middle section where there's just too much going on and way too much repetition. That's my biggest, that is my single biggest problem with GTA 4 is I think the mission structure is unbelievably repetitive. It was repetitive to me at the time. I think the combat is generally very good, even though there's some control wonkiness to it.
Yeah.
But there just came a point in GTA 4 every time I've played it. I've played it at least twice. And it's just, it's always a point where I get kind of tired of playing it, not because necessarily the story has stopped interesting me, because I think in a vacuum, each portion of the story, each character you're with, all of that, it's all interesting and has its different quirks and things that are really interesting and compelling. But it's certainly that middle section, which is very much focused on the middle island, and you've got like five different bosses you're working for. It's just, it's too overstuffed, and it's too overstuffed with gameplay-wise stuff that is repetitive to me. And I think that's my biggest problem with it, is that I think the beginning and end are very tight and very satisfying, and then the middle is kind of just too much of kind of the same thing. Whereas I think narratively, I think there is an interesting point being made in that section with all the different kind of contrasting versions of power and whatnot. But I think, you know, it is a game. The medium of presentation is the interactivity. And when every mission is drive somewhere, kill a shitload of people, drive back, and if you die, you've got to do all that driving again. It's too much for me. It's like it's too much of that. And I've always talked about, you know, the mission everyone loves is the bank robbery. I hate the bank robbery mission. I think it breaks whatever semblance of connection between gameplay and character there was in that game, because you kill every single cop in Liberty City, and that's never brought up again. And it just that always bothered me there. And I don't even think that's a particularly fun mission. It's just not one that interested me even at the time. Maybe before you start killing everyone, there's some interesting things there. But yeah, and you know, again, there's so much good there. It's just that repetition to it is too much for me. And then I've always had different issues with the controls. I think even at the time, a lot of the third-person shooter mechanics felt very, very clunky to me. I thought they were good, but
like, for me, like, that's definitely true. But I'm trying to, like, because there were, like, Gears of War had come out in 2006. But Gears of War is also a very linear-driven, focused third-person shooter game. It's like, Gears of War is, like, kind of the game I look at that, like, got third-person shooting controls right, like, fucking right. But it's like, there was nothing else when GTA 4 came out that sort of, like, put that into like an open world with all those different variables. So it's like, I definitely agree that there are issues with it, but it's like, but I give it, it's kind of like going back to like with San Andreas, like I give it a little bit of credit because nothing else was doing it better at the time. Like if GTA 5 still like had the same shooter controls that GTA 4 did, then I'd have a big problem with it, because lots of games like even Red Dead and Saints Row have done it much better. But like those all came out post GTA 4.
And I can only say what my feelings were on the game. And even at the time, I just felt like this is clunky. This doesn't work as well as it should. Sometimes I keep getting killed because the things that are outside of my control. And I always went kind of back and forth on the driving, where the funnest thing for me to do in Grand Theft Auto is to hop in a car or on a bike and just explore. But at the same time, I think the cars there were always things that bothered me about it, especially sometimes in missions where I felt there was kind of a disconnect between what you needed to be doing with those cars sometimes and what the controls would kind of allow you to do. I don't know if that makes sense, but it just, I think a lot of it was, I came to GTA 4 because I had heard all the hype and I'd seen all the perfect 10 out of 10 reviews and stuff. And to me, it was so clearly, this is great, phenomenal, fantastic, whatever you want to use. I don't think it's perfect. I wish people would stop calling it. And I think I kind of was rebelling against that idea personally when I was playing it, about it was perfect. Because
that's something that everyone brings up when like there you have get like 10 out of 10 reviews and stuff. It's like, everybody knows that nothing is perfect. Like nobody, none of those reviewers that are giving it 5 out of 5 stars are saying that the game is perfect.
I should say it's more than just that. I'm the kind of person, because I write reviews, I don't just look at ratings. I like to really read them. And I think the hyperbole was a little overboard on GTA 4. I really did. I thought, there were people who were describing every element of it as just the ultimate in polish. The ultimate of gaming achievement to date and stuff. And I guess when I had that in mind, the flaws, however minor they were at times, stood out to me more when I played it. And I go back and play it, and I'm still impressed that for a game that is 5 years old, it holds up just fine. You can play that game, and it feels dated to a certain degree because I've played Red Dead.
The shooting feels pretty rough to me now. It's like having lock-on at all is just like very bizarre.
But I can still play it, and it's fine. And honestly, in some ways, the driving is better to me now that I've had more years with the game than when it was at the start. I don't know. It's just like that. That's always kind of been the same to me, where it's not quite perfect, but it's still so much fun. I don't mind.
Yeah.
But like, there are things like I specifically. Here's what I was trying to get to. What I was remembering with the cars is I always thought the races you had to do with like Brucey and stuff were near impossible. I just didn't think the way the cars controlled, you could do something quite as crazy as some of those races were, especially with the handling. I just didn't think the cars were that kind of style of it. So I wouldn't have minded if you didn't have missions like that. Was sort of.
I mean, for
feeling.
Me, I think one of the. Because I go back and forth on how I feel about the GTA 4 driving too, because it is very different from definitely any other open world racing or open world game in general, and that the cars have a lot more weight to them that you have to play it a lot more than you would like a non arcadey racing type game, where it's like you have to brake, like you can't just hold down the accelerator or even just like let off the accelerator to go around turns. Like you have to slow down a certain amount to be able to go around sharp turns because. Fuck, that's how cars work, you know? Like,
right.
it definitely doesn't... It has a much more, like, I guess, kind of mature sense of how cars handle, which isn't necessarily saying that's good, because, like, different people are looking for different things than how your video game car plays. But it's definitely, like, I appreciate that there's a certain amount of skill that you have to possess to drive well in GTA 4. Like, you have to kind of practice at it, you have to figure out the system, that it's not like San Andreas... where you can take, like, be going, like, 80 miles per hour and take a 90-degree turn on a fucking dime. Which is kind of fun, but it's also ridiculous and kind of, like, it's really easy, you know? Like, you don't have any problems controlling the cars in San Andreas, whereas with GTA 4, a lot of the cars are very squirrely, they have a lot of weight, it's really hard to take turns, and you have to figure out the right, with the car, like, how do I brake, how do I go around these turns, and you actually have to think about it, and it takes a lot more skill, which usually I'm not more that into. I definitely like hope with GTA 5 that the driving is more arcadey, because I don't play a lot
of
racing games.
Here's what I would say. I want a balance between the two, because my thought
too.
On GTA 4 was that I always appreciated the effort to do more realistic driving, but I thought it clashed with some of the game's more video gamey aspects.
Sure.
But I also don't want it to be 100% video gamey, arcadey, San Andreas-y, because I think that would be a much thicker kind of ludonarrative dissonance there with what they're trying to do. But I think a middle ground could work better, and hopefully that's what GTA 5 has. I don't need it 100% one way or the other, but something in the middle would probably work best.
Yeah. But anyways, like I want to go back and talk about what you like said with the game being too long, which I do agree. Like it's a complaint I have about basically every Rockstar game. Maybe Max Payne 3 is a pretty good length, but like that's partially because Max Payne 3, like the combat's so much fun that you don't mind the length. But definitely, like GTA 4 and Red Dead both have this like weird issue of like where it tells like both of those games tell a lot of stories, just like dozens of stories because of all the different characters you encounter. And like either like approaching them as Nico Bellic and like seeing, like you said, all these like contrasting like versions of power and different views of what the American dream is. And both of those games, like you tell all these different stories, but you still have to have this like overarching main story for like Nico. It's he wants to find, I can't remember his name, but like the one guy, like he's trying to find those two guys from Serbia that like that were in the army and stuff and trying to figure out what happened in that Serbian war. And like eventually like he finds the one dude and then he has to find the other guy. It has that overarching story, and then once you get to the middle, that overarching story barely even budges. Like the pacing for that is so slow, but you still have all these really interesting side stories going on in the middle that are interesting in their own right, but a lot of times it's like really hard to focus on them when you know there's something bigger going on. Like obviously Red Dead has the same thing when you get to the Mexico section. The Mexico section by itself, I think, is actually the most interesting part of the game if you isolate it. And I really like the Mexico section. A lot of people have problems with it. And I see why, because it's like the Mexico section, in terms of the overarching narrative of trying to find like all the members of your old gang, it doesn't fucking nothing. Like it only moves until once you get to the very end. And all the rest of Mexico and Red Dead is you fucking around with the Mexican Civil War. Which is cool, but it's like...
And I definitely had a feeling with Mexico where I guess I was aware of that issue, but I love the Mexico section so much it never bothered me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, I actually feel that way also about GTA 4, where I definitely recognize the problems with it. And I do agree that, like, the missions in GTA 4 get pretty repetitive. I mean, it's also... I think Red Dead also has that problem where at some point the missions get so repetitive where it's just like, it's all, okay, I'm going to drive a car or ride a horse here and kill everybody. And while I'm on the way, I'm going to have a conversation with this dude, and then there's going to be a cutscene, and then I have to do another mission. You know, like, that's basically 90% of the missions in both of those games, and it definitely is a flaw. But I think the writing and the... Particularly all the... Just, like, the different characters that you meet along the way are also interesting and funny and weird and kind of depressing in all their own unique way that, like, I didn't really have a problem with it. That's like, I almost look at GTA 4 and Red Dead. They're a lot more kind of like miniseries than like an HBO style miniseries than they are like a movie where it's like you have.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely have this like overarching thing just to give everything context. But the actual meat, like what you're really supposed to be like looking at throughout the game, is these like individual vignettes, all these individual characters you meet along the way. And that's kind of like they're all their own episode in their own way. And I find that really interesting. But it's a lot harder to sort of like. I think a lot of people have difficulty parsing that out because it isn't presented in an episodic format whatsoever. It is presented almost like it would be a movie, and this is this one whole big chunk of thing, and you're all consuming it possibly in like 12 to 15 hour sittings if you're crazy. And that's, you know, it's harder to look at that as being episodic. It's the same thing fucking L.A. Noire has the same problem, where I really like it because I look at it as it being totally episodic, and a lot of people have complaints about how repetitive it is, but I'm like,
it's like a procedural.
Yeah, exactly. It's
a
like
Law and Order.
Yeah, each of these cases is its own episode, its own story. And I think even if I played it in when I played it in longer sittings, I think it's just something about the way I approach those games is it's easier for me personally to like almost hit this mental switch of like reset and like treat the next thing as like it being an episode and just like look at it as its own thing. And I enjoy it more that way. And I totally recognize how like other people, the way they approach it, just like that's not possible for them.
Well, yeah, and some people want, you know, if you're going to have a game with a story that goes from point A to B to C to D and stuff, you kind of just want the story. And obviously these are open world games. There's a lot of other stuff around them. But yeah.
Yeah, no, and I definitely recognize that complaint. And I think Red Dead handled it better mostly, that like when the main story stuff happened in Red Dead, it always felt a lot more significant and momentous. And there's a lot more less like cooler big story moments in Red Dead, particularly the ending, than there are in GTA 4.
But even then, I did think Red Dead was significantly more dynamic throughout. And the missions are repetitive in a way, but I feel like just because of the setting, even, and,
yeah,
and
I think
the gunplay,
the setting, and like the Red Dead has a lot better pacing in the sense of like it's a lot more fun to inhabit the world, like, and a lot of that is due to the setting of like they're able to put like shit in the game, like, oh, I'm just riding down this path on a horse, and this dude comes up to me, he's like, those fuckers are hanging my wife over by like Hanging Rock, and I'm like, well, what were you doing hanging around Hanging Rock? What did you expect? And then you have to go like save that dude's wife.
Yeah.
I love, or kill stuff like her that. Or like take her in like while she's still wrapped up, if you and like take her to a church and then just like sacrifice her like she's like on an Aztec altar or something.
I have done
like,
that.
Eat her alive or something. I don't know what the fuck you do, you monster.
I wish you had the option to skin people and wear their skin like Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. That's all I want, people.
Yeah, Ed Gein, motherfucker.
And you know what? I've heard GTA 5 has that same mechanic.
What? Where skinning people alive?
No. Where you go? No. Where you go around?
You might want to clarify that statement before you just move on.
Where you're going around the world and people will ask you to help
them
with stuff.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah, which sounds
like
fun.
GTA 4 has a little bit of it. They have like the GTA 4 has these weird stranger missions, but they're really light and like there's like nothing. There's no substance to them.
Here's the other thing I was going to say about Red Dead Redemption on that front. When we were talking about the overarching story, just purely by nature of the time it is set in. Red Dead never bothered me when the overall story wasn't progressing, because I think there's a difference when you live in a world where you are not inherently connected to the rest of the world.
Sure.
Where when he's down in Mexico, I think it makes much more sense for that his personal arc to be stagnated a little than it does for Nico Bellic, because he's in Mexico. He's not going to leave until he has this resolved, and he's not connected to other parts of the world because there isn't internet or phones or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's just, and I just think there's just, you can get away with a slower pace in Red Dead because it was a slower time.
Sure.
And I think Red Dead has just such a clear sense of the voice of a slower world.
Sure.
And I think that works really well. So
I agree.
Yeah. One other problem I have with GTA 4, and I think it's a problem with Red Dead, and I anticipate it will be an issue with GTA 5, and it's just something Rockstar does that's always kind of befuddled me, is there's a lot of gameplay elements in GTA 4 and Red Dead that feels extraneous to me. Like, we have the bowling and the darts and things like that.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And some things where you go out with your friends. And then in GTA 4, there's poker and stuff, which I actually think is kind of fun, because what I do is I play poker, cheat, stand up and kill everyone and take their money.
Yeah,
I love that. But then there's stuff like,
I mean, in Red Dead, I really like playing Liar's Dice.
That's going to be fun.
It's a cool game.
I think it's much more polished in Red Dead, but even then, none of it feels like they've put, like, none of it feels like those mini games are really fully integrated, I guess. More in Red Dead because they're so period specific, I guess. But in GTA 4, definitely was something where, especially when you would have to go on a mission with like your girlfriend or something and go bowling, and I'm like, get me the fuck out of this. I wish I were shooting people. This is horrible.
I mean, but that only happens like twice. Like, one of the things with GTA 4 that people complain about all the time that makes me mad because I don't think it's a valid complaint is people complain, it's a system I actually really like, that GTA 4 has with the phone, you know, you can go hang out with people, and then it's like they have like favors and stuff where it's like, oh, if you go like go bowling with little Jacob like 1,000 times or whatever the fuck it is, he'll like go deliver weapons if you call him. And like each person, each friend you encounter, if you get their favor up high enough by going out on activities with them, it'll give you a little bonus. But like one of the things everyone always complains about is that, like, everyone's always like, oh, I'm driving around and I just want to be playing the game, and then Roman calls me on my fucking cell phone and he's like, hey, motherfucker, like I want to go bowling and titties and all that shit. And Roman's being wacky the way Roman's always being wacky. And you, people just want to play the game. And they don't give a fuck about Roman. And it's like, you do, of course, realize in the cell phone, in the fucking game, there's a setting you can go, you can fucking just go put it on silent mode. You can just go down, put it on silent mode, and nobody calls you, and you can just play the game how you want. Like, if you don't want to engage with those systems, the game doesn't force you to. But if you do elect to engage with the systems, you benefit from it. So it's like, if you don't find that shit interesting, you can completely ignore it. So it's like, it's not a complaint that makes sense to me, I guess. Because I also enjoyed those systems. I liked going and hanging out with people and seeing like the Ricky Gervais is in the game and shit like that. And like Cat Williams.
Here's what I would say. I like hanging out with people. I actually really like the system of people calling you because I think it makes the world feel so alive. Yeah. It makes you feel more connected to your character. I like all that. I just wish on the other end of it, what you go and do with those people, sometimes, if it's not comedy club or drinking, it really feels underwhelming to me and underbaked.
You can see that. I mean, they're mini games, you know, like, and I like, didn't have a huge problem with it because it's like, what, there's darts, there's bowling, but like you said, you can go see those shows. Is there anything else? Are there any other like major mini games that I'm forgetting? Like you can go drinking too and get fucking.
I love going drinking. I do that all the time.
Watch the character animations fuck up.
Yellow car. Yeah, I love exactly, it. It's great.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, it's like. I mean, I kind of see where you're coming because it's like I don't love the bowling mini game, and there's like the one mission where you're with Michelle and you have to do the bowling mini game.
They had. And it's not the point of the game, but if it's going to be in there, if they had a really kind of fun version of bowling there, I would be more I would be more enticed to hang out with Roman and do a variety of things rather than drinking with him every time, because that's the only thing I find entertaining there if I've already watched the comedy shows.
But it's like, I don't know, like, fucking, like, I barely even like the bowling in Wii Sports, so, like, I don't find bowling, I don't think you can make a bowling minigame.
Then they need to do minigames like Mario Party, just super crazy, where you're suddenly in the clouds.
But that's, and therein lies the catch-22 of, like, they have to, like, it has to be bowling, or it has to be darts, like, it has to be something that people would actually fucking do.
What they should do is you go see a movie, and they, like, license movies, like, from big studios that are on the disc,
exactly.
And you watch them. That would make total sense, right?
Yeah, that would be financially, I think, that would, you just get so much benefit from that, right?
Who knows? GTA 5 cost a lot. They may have done that.
Yeah, I fucking know. I'm sure it costs enough money to license all the music. I don't think they're going to go license, like, fucking Lord of the Rings or something on top of it.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah, that'd be fucking awesome. But
That's how they released the Hobbit Extended Cut, is through GTA 5. It's the only way to see it.
Mm-hmm. But going back to the mini games, like there's even something that I almost appreciate about like how the mundane aspect of that, of like, you know, it's just fucking Brucey just calls you up and he's like, "Yo, motherfucker, I want to go bowling," and you're like,
"Why not?
I don't really want to go bowling. I kind of want to hang out with Brucey though, because Brucey's a weird, crazy, funny kind of dude. So fuck it, yeah, let's just go bowling." And it's like, I don't know. It's a world building aspect of the game that I actually really appreciate, even if it's not. Like, I don't necessarily mind that it's not really fun because it's immersive. It's almost like a lot of people complain about the planet scanning in Mass Effect 2.
I love
like,
planet scanning in Mass Effect really, 2.
Because it's boring and it's dumb. I recognize it's kind of a boring, dumb, weird thing that's like
but,
to gather resources.
I got this.
Sure.
You're the captain of a friggin' starship. You've got work to do. Sometimes that work involves fighting the blue suns. Sometimes it means scanning planet. It's your responsibility. You know, take your lumps. Do it.
Exactly. It's a weird, fun little... Like, it's not fun. It isn't fun. It's just this weird thing that you have to do. Because you're a fucking starship captain. It's like, I don't necessarily want every game to, like... you know, you have a fucking I have to go to the bathroom mini game. Like, you don't have to rep, like eating has to be a part of every single game. I don't want that. I don't want it to try to accurately replicate actually everything in everyone's life. But I think video games having a little mundaneness to them, just like throwing in this like part of ordinary life to sort of like level everything out a bit, to sort of like give you some downtime, some like relaxing, just weird like inhabiting the world. I appreciate that, because I think it's, video games don't have to be balls to the wall action and fun and super engaging and entertaining in that very visceral way 100% of the time, especially not if you're an open world game that it's like you're really meant to inhabit, to get invested, to immerse yourself into this fictional world. And I appreciate those aspects of GTA 4. Like, of course they could be done better,
you know what?
Like anything. But I fucking, when I played the game, I fucking loved it. I was like, yeah, sure, fuck it, Roman, like, little Jacob, let's go see the Ricky Gervais show. Like, let's go
and
do it.
And you know what? Now that you made that Mass Effect 2 planet scanning comparison, which is something I feel very strongly about, as you just heard,
yeah,
I retract that complaint. Yeah, I see what you mean by that now, and I kind of, and maybe, and again, I think a lot of my complaints with GTA 4 come from a place where I was a much less experienced gamer when I played the game, and I do wonder how I would feel about some of these systems if I went back and actually, because I've dicked around in GTA 4 a lot in the last couple of years. I obviously have not sat down and played GTA 4.
Same with me. I haven't played, like, properly played it in 4 years, according to
saves. So. Which is honestly one of the things I'm so excited for on GTA 5 is that online, it seems like something where the kind of dicking around aspect will be given much longer life.
Yeah.
So, and much more variety, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But, do we have anything else to say on GTA 4?
I have one more. This, to me, this single thing is the most defining and my favorite aspect of any modern Rockstar game that was introduced, I believe, in GTA 4.
Hookers.
No. No, because there aren't any hookers in Max Payne 3. So
okay.
No. But it was introduced in GTA 4. It was used in Red Dead Redemption. I believe it was also used in L.A. Noir. It was definitely used to fantastic effect in Max Payne 3.
Shotguns.
No. I'm fucking saying it's the natural motion euphoria physics engine for body movement.
Oh, it's great, yeah.
Which is, I don't know why no other game has used this. Like, I haven't looked up to, like maybe Rockstar, like, has an exclusive deal with it or something. Like, because, weirdly enough, it was actually originally introduced in Star Wars The Force Unleashed. Which used that and another, like, physics engine that allowed, like, made interesting bending of, like, organic and metal materials that was very realistic. But the Natural Motion Euphoria physics engine is a physics engine that is designed specifically to operate on like, people movement, like, your bodily movement and your skeletal movement. And it's just really, the level of verisimilitude it gives the game of just, like, like, the movements feel so realistic, and it is one of the things that makes getting drunk in GTA 4 or Red Dead so much fun, is just seeing them, like, switch a flip on that physics engine and just seeing the people stumble around in this really dynamic but really funny and interesting way that, like, is really over the top. Like, you'd have to be completely fucking smashed to actually look like that in real life. But yeah, like, the level of just, like, when you fucking run over someone with a car in GTA 4... the way that impact affects that person is just, like, it's so real. Like the way they move, the way they hit, slam into the car, and their, like, head hits the windshield, and they, like, roll over the top. It's so far and beyond way better than any, like, person movement physics engine I've seen in any other game. That's, like, this is one of the things I look forward to the most whenever I play a Rockstar game. It's just, like, it's just a small little detail that makes every little impact, every time you shoot someone, every time you run someone over, every time you get hit, feel all the more impactful and all the more just like, oh, fuck, like, this is, yeah, this is intense.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of the best parts about Max Payne 3 is just watching what happens when you, in Max Payne 3, you dive into a wall on accident and, like, fucking this old, like, 50-year-old dude just, like, full on with, like, every, like, fucking muscle in his body just jumped and dove headfirst into a fucking cinder block, and watching him sort of, like, crumple after that and being like, oh, ow, oh, fucking shit, that...
Is it like that watching me, like, trip over myself?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you want to see what it's like to watch Jonathan in real life try to move his cumbersome human body, just, like, just play Max Payne 3 and dive into walls. It's basically what I'm saying. It's a fantastic Jonathan simulation experience. But yeah, no, like, the natural, I'm so excited to see, because they improve it incrementally with each title, too. So, like, because Max Payne 3 was definitely the best use of it so far, so I'm really excited to see what that brings to GTA 5 and how crazy that will be.
Yeah. So, I don't think there's much we need to say about Red Dead right now, because we talked about it on our previous Best Of podcast.
Yeah, we've done Red Dead to death.
Yeah. Anything else to say beyond, I play it super fucked up, and we both love the game.
No. I think we we solved it. You crazy motherfucker.
And you've talked about Max Payne 3.
Yeah.
So, I think this ties up our Rockstar retrospective kind of stuff. But, I mean, let's take it back to, you know, GTA 5's coming out tomorrow. We're going to be playing it soon. What specifically are you kind of hoping for, and what are you so excited for with this game?
There are three main things that I'm really, like, looking forward to. Like, outside of just, like, the general story, because, of course, that's going to be cool. But I'm really interested to see the three main protagonists and how that works, like, switching between them, what that brings to the game, and what it brings to... Like, I'm hoping it fixes some of those pacing issues with the story, that it'll be like, okay, like, now that I've played as fucking, like Michael for 5 hours, I can move on and see sort of, like, the Franklin side of the story and stuff. Like, I'm interested to see how all that works mechanically. And then... I also, like, I'm really... One of my big hopes for, in terms of, like, the gameplay, what they do is, like, I want to see how much the shooting has improved. Specifically after, since they've made Max Payne 3, which was just a straight-up third-person shooter and worked amazingly just as a third-person shooter, I want to see, like, what that experience brings back into GTA 5. Because if GTA 5 has shooting even anywhere near close to the level of satisfaction that Max Payne 3 had, it's going to be a fucking crazy game. Because that's... Because no open-world game has... Like, that's always the part where open world games fall down to me, is this, like, the combat has gotten a lot better and is totally serviceable, but it's never, like, great. And it's always something that's like, yeah, it's kind of fun, but it's not really... You come to the game for the world and the exploration and the story aspect of it, and so that's what I'm really excited for. And then, I can't remember fucking... What was my other third... Planes. I just want, like, the whole world and the planes and getting that and just, like... Being in fucking like Los Santos again, but now having like this GTA 4 style engine and having airplanes and like skydiving and all this shit,
yeah,
looks cool. Like the whole map looks, it's cool that they're going back to Los Santos, I guess.
Yeah, and really being able to give it what it deserves.
Yeah.
I'm just excited because I just the idea of having an open world as big as the one they're making sounds so exciting to me.
Yeah,
I mean, this is what hit me last night, and this is kind of the point I feel like I want to leave things on, is that I was playing GTA 4 last night, the Ballad of Gay Tony, and I was just kind of, you know, fooling around in it, and I was in a gunfight with the cops, and I had a 6-star wanted level, and I was running away because my car blew up, and I ran into this little shed in an alleyway. And I realized this is, you know, I've played so much GTA 4, but this is something I've never seen before.
Yeah.
It's this little shed. And I had this fantastic shootout where that was a defensible position. And I fought off all these cops. And it was like, you know, even all these years later, there are parts of that map I've never seen. And that's a fairly confined open world map.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to see GTA 5 and just to see what kind of life there will be to it. Because that's something that just... I think that's the thing that Red Dead, for me, set that game apart from everything else, was the level of life you felt playing Red Dead, even though it was kind of this dead, arid, desert environment. It's just that world felt so alive and inhabited, and I feel like bringing that ethos to the modern world, and also seeing story-wise what Rockstar will satire 5 years later,
now that
we have a whole new set of problems in America, what are we going to see? I'm super excited.
Yeah, so I guess, like... Yeah, I think combining both of ours, I think the most interesting part of like going into GTA 5 is that it has been 5 years since they've made a GTA 4 game, but they made games in between there. And like in Max Payne 3, fantastic combat. In Red Dead Redemption, then partially because of the setting, they were able to bring a lot more life, a lot more like side stuff, a lot more just investment into the open world. And so the cool thing is going to be seeing how Rockstar has matured and how they're going to bring these lessons they learned in those two different games back to their marquee franchise, GTA. And just seeing, like, this is for this generation. Rockstar has, like, has this, like, long arc, and this is, like, their peak. This is what they're trying to hit. This is, the very fucking end of this generation, the end of these consoles. And so it's, like, hopefully GTA 5 can represent the pinnacle of what they've been trying to do all along the way.
Yeah. And I think just looking at the trailers and stuff, it's crazy that game is coming out on PS3 and Xbox.
Yeah. It looks fucking great.
Yeah. If they ever do a next-gen port, I wonder what that would look like, too.
Yeah, there was like some, I don't know how much bullshit, this is probably total bullshit because it seemed like bullshit, but there was like a rumor going around that like someone had cracked the code on the 360 version or something like that and like seen the hints at like PC and PS4 versions or something, so...
That sounds weird. I don't know if
it sounds like
that.
Fucking bullshit to me. Like, I don't know why that would be in the code of the game or whatever. But, like, I mean, they're almost definitely.
Did they find a
PC
sex
version.
Mini game?
Hopefully. Like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, hopefully they found it and it's actually in the game this time instead of getting fucking ripped out. God damn it.
Yeah, I want
like,
my hot
you're
coffee.
Going to put, yeah, if you're going to put a sex mini game in the game, it's like, just put it in there. Because if you put it in there and then, like, you kind of rip it out, but there's still remnants of it, and then someone finds the remnants, then all of a sudden your game has an AO rating, and this gets, like, pulled from the stores, and then you have to go back and, like, take it out and then, like, reprint all the discs and send it back out. It's like, just make it a fucking sex mini game in the first place, god damn it.
And you know, if we wanted to fix the problem of the AO rating, I feel like Rockstar would be in the perfect position to do that, because if they made a game that got an AO, it wouldn't matter for them. Everyone would reverse their policies. Like, we'll sell this game because we want to make that money. That's sweet, sweet GTA money. So anyway.
Yep.
Hopefully we get our hardcore AO Grand Theft Auto sometime.
See, I like how, like, I tried to end this discussion on this nice, like, sort of looking back and, like painting this, like, arc of the story of where Rockstar had been developing. And then somehow you brought it back around to sex minigame and just, like, threw the discussion into the gutter.
So in the sex minigame, hypothetically, in GTA 5, would you be able to kill your partner mid-coitus?
You would find a way, I am sure. Yes, without a doubt. You would find some fucked up... Yeah, no.
All right.
Don't worry about it, Jonathan. We'll find a way.
I'm just... like Rockstar, I'm trying to push our podcast to new heights, although in terms of vulgarity, you know, as much as I can.
Sure.
Anyway, so I'll take a deep breath, talk about something else. Okay. You want to talk some Mass Effect, Sean?
Sure.
Okay.
In this podcast on a really just, like, happy... fun note, talking about the ending of Mass Effect 3. It's just, like, lightning, and it's so joyful.
I'm just super curious to talk about this with you.
Sure.
And I think I want to recap really quick. You know, talking about the Mass Effect 3 ending has been something... That's kind of an arc on our podcast.
Yeah, it's like Red Dead Redemption in that way. It's a recurring thing.
One of the... it was either the first or second episode ever of the Monthly Stuff podcast, second podcast.
Yeah, fuck God, we recorded it in your dorm.
Yep. Sean had finished Mass Effect 3 over the weekend, played it all in, like, 2 days.
Yeah, it was one of those, like, I've said multiple times, my favorite way to finish a game, the way I know a game is fucking amazing, is if when I finish it, the sun is rising.
Yes.
So it's like, I finished Mass Effect 3 at, like, 4 or 5 in the morning.
And then he came to school, and then came and recorded a podcast with me, because he's a crazy person. So yeah, and you talked about it then, and I think, you know, back then... The ending controversy was still getting going, you know?
Yeah, I remember I had known that it's like people did not like the ending, but it wasn't yet like people were writing petitions.
And
it wasn't like new DLC was coming out to explain it. Like, that shit had not started yet.
And I actually remember that conversation pretty clearly because you also were still processing it all.
Yeah.
And you weren't at the point of saying it was the best, you know, it was a phenomenal ending. You were just saying, I really liked the ending.
Yeah,
you were
like, like I said, like it was like 12 hours after I had finished the game. So I was still thinking about it. Yeah, like that, because that ending fucking affected me deeply. Like that, like I thought about that for like fucking weeks. It like wrecked my life.
Me too, because I think that ending it really affected me too. Where I think after I finished it at 12 midnight, and I stayed up till 2, not doing anything else, just kind of sitting and thinking about it. I typed up some notes. Just did some, you know, mental exercises to get through it. And then the next day, it was all just... I tried to play some other games, but it was just like, I have to keep thinking about this. Wrote some more notes. Talked to my brother about it, and we'll have a funny conversation about that. Because he had a really weird interpretation of the ending to me. And then it was the next day, too. It was just a lot of thinking about that game. The music from the last couple hours just kept running through my head. I think... That is a truly thought-provoking ending.
And I
just love that Mass Effect, the series, is so big and sweeping and has such a rich mythology and everything, and then they can all bring it to this point that is profoundly thought-provoking and just goes off in so many different directions that we will not see from this point, but we can imagine and think about and will stay. And that's why Mass Effect will kind of always stay with me, you know?
Yeah.
So let's just go right into it, talk about the ending.
Okay, sure. Like, spoilers abound from this point onward.
Yeah. So you get to the end, you talk to... You're up on the Crucible, on the Citadel. You're talking to the AI, the VI that is the Catalyst.
Yeah, the original AI.
And there's three choices. You can destroy the Reapers and all artificial life. you can try to control the Reapers,
yeah.
or there's that third option, the Beyond, the green one, Synthesis.
Yeah.
And you chose...
I chose Synthesis.
And I chose Synthesis because I'm not fucking crazy.
Yeah, sure.
Why would you choose the other two? I don't get why people choose the other two. It makes no sense to me. It's so fucking obvious what the arc of that game is to me. But I guess I have trouble getting out of my own head because I have...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, other people have different, like, sort of approaches to the story and what it's about.
And I think that's what's interesting to me because I actually kind of want to back up before we start talk about the ending and talk about Mass Effect 3 as a whole for a little bit, because Mass Effect 3 as a whole was very thought-provoking to me. And it was interesting I played it. It was, you know, sort of the game I played after finishing Persona 3.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thematic parallels between
those
two games.
That's one hell of a double feature.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're both very much about how, in Persona 3, humans, and in Mass Effect 3, organic life, deal with the concept of death.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, Mass Effect 3 is a very similar arc to Persona 3, where it's saying very clearly, death makes us better.
Yeah.
That I think... The Mass Effect, and I guess Mass Effect 3 felt very culminatory because everything I had observed over the first two games, I was using to inform my thematic interpretation of 3.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I think one of the things I've always picked up on in Mass Effect is that this is a really, really dark world. This is a world where every single race is defined by the atrocities they have committed.
Yeah.
The Turians and the Salarians by the Genophage, the Krogans by the horrible things they did to make the Genophage, and then their mercenary years afterwards, the Quarians by the Geth by their association with the Reapers, the humans by... Well, we know what atrocities humans have committed.
Yeah, I know what atrocities you fucking committed, you horrible monster.
Only in Red Dead.
Space Hitler? Like, Jesus.
Yeah. But no, and so... And in Mass Effect 2 particularly, which is... Mass Effect 2 is a darker game than it looks like on the surface.
It's the dark middle chapter of the franchise.
It's very much you are...
It's the dark orange chapter, really.
Yeah. You're working with the bad... With sort of a seedy organization in Cerberus.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to a lot of dark, seedy places like Omega, which is obviously bad. But then you also go to places like Thessia, which is... It looks nice on the surface. And is Thessia the right word? It's the big city in 2. It's where you find Liara.
I can't remember if Thessia is the...
Ilium.
Because Thessia is Liara's homeworld.
Okay.
I knew Thessia was not the right one, but I was trying
An Asari planet,
Ilium.
Yeah. Right. So Ilium looks like utopian on the surface, but it's got a really dark underbelly. You spend the majority of Mass Effect 2 sort of with, you know, scoundrels and scumbags and in very dark places. And this galaxy is just very dark, very broken, crippled by political inaction and an inability to understand each other. And then you get to 3, and because the Reapers, who represent death much in the same way death represents death in Persona 3, you have... Everyone becomes better because of this. You get the Krogans and the Turians to work together if you do it the right way.
Yeah.
You get...
Or you can fuck all that up and just everyone's dead. Like,
yeah.
Or death makes you just dead. Like, right. That's the other possible interpretation outcome of Mass Effect 3.
Yeah.
Mass Effect 2.
Right. But anyway, the way I played it, you know, you get the Krogans and the Turians to... The Krogans get their future. The Turians get new allies. The Salarians even come around. The Asari just kind of get fucked.
Yeah.
But then the Quarians and the Geth, the Quarians are finally able to realize what atrocities they did to the Geth. The Geth are able to sort of forgive and forget and kind of evolve, basically.
Yeah.
They are able to live together. The Quarians get to go back to their homeworld. Humanity gets all these allies. You have such a closer relationship with everyone by the end of that game.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you've lived this very fulfilling life even before you go into that final battle, and everyone is sort of... has kind of made peace by the time they go to war at the end, knowing they don't want to die, but they've done everything they can, if you've played the game right. And I think that's just all super fascinating, and I think it's just such a cool arc of, very similar to Persona 3, it's about the perspective death gives you.
Yeah.
And I think that's super interesting. And so throughout Mass Effect 3, with that in mind, I was really curious about how on earth this game was going to wrap up. Because it felt like, on one level, thematically, they could do the ending where the Reapers just kill everyone, and it would still have that resonance.
Yeah.
Or they could do... But it's still, like, gameplay mechanics-wise, with sort of the readiness rating and all that,
mm-hmm.
it felt like we were building up to some kind of victory. And I was wondering what was going to happen, and really the ending is kind of a combination of all of that, with much bigger philosophical ideas at heart.
Yeah.
It actually... The ending where you talk with the Catalyst... And there's this chance for an evolution of all life in the galaxy and stuff. It felt very much Stanley Kubrick-esque to me.
Yeah, 2001. Definitely. I mean, And it's one of, like, the thing about the ending is that it is a very heavily philosophical style ending. Like, it is very Kubrick in how, like, kind of cold it is in a lot of ways. Like, couched in this, like, really heavy emotion. And I think like, for me, like, one of the problems looking at it from the outside, because both of us really like the ending, is that a lot of people, since it is such a character-heavy franchise and you become so attached to the characters, I think a lot of people wanted a much more character-focused style of ending to the game. Like, almost kind of more Persona 3-esque style ending instead of this, like, really, like, high philosophical sort of, like, the stuff with the cycles and stuff. It's very thought-provoking and it's very interesting, but it's not, like, this emotional-based, like, character-based ending. But I think, and maybe you feel the same way, like, one of the reasons why I love this version of the ending for Mass Effect 3, like, this very philosophical version, is one, it feels very appropriate to the genre.
Absolutely.
Ultimately, Mass Effect is science fiction, it is not science fantasy, you know, it's not Star Wars, it's much more Star Trek, and it lends itself much more to this heavily philosophical style ending. And then also, I think the ending itself almost sort of represents the contrast between of what, like, the whole, like, sort of themes of the series ultimately come to be, which is this organics versus synthetics, which is definitely the theme if you go for synthesis, and that, like, the ending is super cold, the ending is super synthetic, because you are being presented this ending from this AI that's, like, this AI that is, like, millions if not billions of years old. Like, my interpretation is, like, it's the original AI made from, like, the original cycle that survived all this time. And so, like, the ending is super cold, but, like, you are experiencing all this emotion because you are this human, because you've had all of this experience. And so, like, that harsh contrast, I think, for a lot of people, they don't like it. And I'm not saying if, like, you don't like it, that makes you stupid or something, you're looking at the story the wrong way. But, like, it's obvious to me why it's a polarizing ending, because it's, like, a really strange thing to go for. But for me, it makes it really interesting and just kind of emotionally devastating in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that, because I think I agree with you, and I think you have to, and this is what I find interesting from a role-playing element with Shepard, where I feel like my Shepard is equipped and prepared to do this by the end, but you have to step out of your own shoes, and you're being asked to do that, and I think the ending, to me, does have this character hook to it, and it's your character, it's Shepard, because asking you, I think it's the ultimate test for Shepard of, can you only see the life you've lived, and the course of your life, or can you see the totality of space and time?
Yeah.
And really, I think synthesis is an ending where you're looking at the totality of space and time. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to, you know, all your experiences and everything you've accumulated, to me, led me to see, I am so small. But I have the chance to do something big here.
Yeah.
And I think the red ending is the prototypical, this is my life, this is all I have, is fighting the Reapers, I have to blow them up.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I talked with my brother for a good hour after we finished this, because he finished Mass Effect 3 a couple months ago, and he's been waiting for me to finish it because he wanted to talk to me about it. And so I finished
Can I just ask first, like, does he, like, regardless of how he feels, like, about, like, the themes, does he like the ending or dislike
it? Loves it.
Okay.
And he picked the red ending.
Okay.
And I kind of gave him my whole spiel on why I picked the green ending and my thematic reasons for it, which we'll talk about soon. And he's like, I don't get it. And he really kind of didn't get my reasoning. He thought, and I'll get into his specific interpretations later, but, you know, he was very tied up in, if I don't blow up the Reapers here, then what have I accomplished? And I can see that if you're seeing the character-focused side of it, that's for your character, is that this is my arc, this is what I've done, you know, this is what I've been working towards, that's what's presented to me. And he was also looking in a very narrative-strict way, and I asked him, well, Thomas, I guess why I didn't pick the red ending was I didn't see what was thematically interesting about it, and he didn't really have any thematic interpretation. And I'm not saying he's stupid for that. He just was much more narrative-focused on that, I guess. And for me, about synthesis was, and I have so many things to say about this ending and why it felt so right to me, but I guess I spent a lot of the game thinking about the idea of binary mortality, because one of the things Mass Effect 3 does to, I think, set you down this path of thinking about that is that it takes out the neutral option from Paragon Renegade conversations.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, at first I was kind of like, huh, I wonder why that's gone. And as I went, I realized it kind of has to be gone Because the point Shepard is at, the point everyone in this galaxy is at...
You can't make this middle choice. Like, the middle choice just isn't presented to you. Like, it's like...
Yeah.
If things have gone so extreme, you cannot be on the fence right. anymore about fucking anything, or you're yeah. dead immediately.
And so I think you get into this pattern of, we have to stop the Reapers. It's binary. Them yeah. versus us. All these things. But then as you start having different conversations with, like, a Reaper you've killed who tells you about the importance of the cycle,
yeah.
or when you talk to the Catalyst at the end, or other things in the middle, and as I, for instance, started to become aware of this theme of death making the galaxy better, I started questioning, are the Reapers evil? Or is this just the place they fulfill, and I'm having trouble seeing it because my specific existence in this world, in this universe, is being yeah. threatened? And by the time I got to the end, and so much shit had gone wrong, and those last 3 hours are so stressful, Shepard and then me as an extension, or me and then Shepard as an extension, I felt like at this sort of place of almost like transcendence. Like, I was yeah. seeing more.
Transcendence.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, well, I'll talk about that more in a minute, but no.
You met Kurt Cobain, you achieved Nirvana. Yeah, exactly. Transcendence.
No, but anyway, yeah, I kind of felt like in this sort of different altered state, and I was able to think about, and especially with talking to the Catalyst, and about these issues, and the Catalyst saying, I invented the cycle because what happens is organic species rise, they create machines, and then, as always happens, the created want to kill the creators, and chaos reigns, and we have to restore order. And given everything I've seen, and I, you know, Shepard having this knowledge of the cycle he/she exists in, and then also the knowledge of these prior cycles, knowing about the Protheans and hearing about all this, yeah. I saw that that's true. That is good logic on the AI's part. It's horrible on my side for
yeah,
what's happening.
But like, if the AI, if the Reapers were not doing what they were doing, life would cease to exist. At all, or, yes. or potentially could cease to exist at all if, like, a cycle went particularly bad and just, like, no life happened to spring up again on another planet, all of existence would end. So the Reapers sort of, like, cull the life that has gotten too extreme, preserve, like, some of the races, and so the Vlad almost has, like, this kind of morbid museum as Reapers themselves. That's what you learn in Mass Effect 2. And then, like, they select new races to keep around that in Mass Effect 3, you find out it's, like, the race of the original Shadow Broker is selected to eventually become, like, sort of like the new Asari or humanity or whatever they're going to be, and allow, like, this new version of life to flourish and allow diversity in life in the galaxy to continue.
And
if they didn't do that, it couldn't.
Right. And when I noted earlier that the Mass Effect series is very dark, that's what I'm talking about, is that yeah. knowing that in the back of my mind, when I hear the Catalyst say that, something clicks, which is that, yeah, you know what? We have done horrible things. And if the Reapers didn't come, and I didn't... The Reapers gave me the chance to cure the Genophage. They gave yeah. me the chance to bring the Turians and Krogans together. They made me, in this series, fall in love with the romance I chose. Yeah. All these things. They did make us better at the very end. And if they weren't there, we would have gotten even worse and more horrible. And even if I, Shepard, am a hero and a good person or something, I have to look at totality here because I'm at the Crucible. I've been tasked with representing this galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is so much bigger than me, and these ideas are so much bigger than me. And I think, you know, also talking about binary mortality and stuff, the actual mechanic of choice at the end, where you have control, destroy, and the synthesis,
yeah.
and, well, there's blue, red, and then beyond, green.
Yes.
And it's very clearly to me, it's talking about the question you are presented with at the end there, then, is can you get out of your own life and look at the beyond option, or are you still thinking kind of binary? And I think there's such a commentary there on even organic species who invent machines that are binary.
Yeah.
We're very binary too in that way.
Yeah.
And in Shepard's, just Shepard's choice to look for the beyond and see this sort of form of transcendent new life in synthesis, that proves that that can work. That can be something new, because that's breaking out of these binary thought cycles that have created the secular nature of the universe and the galaxy with the Reaper yeah. cycles. And so to me, it was like, I go through all this thought in my head, and it's just, immediately I was drawn towards that, you know, brilliant white light in the sky that is the synthesis choice. And it's just, it felt so right. And then also, you know, very Kubrickian in the idea of the next evolution of life is starting.
Yeah, you become yeah. a star child, effectively.
Right. And then, but also I was thinking...
I mean, you die.
Right.
Something maybe you can become the star child.
Yeah. And then on the flip side of that, I think there's this issue of choice being... I mean, I think the ending of Mass Effect 3 is tremendously metatextual.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I actually think Mass Effect 3 on the whole is subtly metatextual, and then it becomes very overtly at the end. But I think the metatext is really interesting with this idea of choice is the core gameplay mechanic outside of the shooting and biotics.
And choice is it's the most interesting gameplay mechanic. It's what you come to the franchise for, is the choice.
Absolutely. Even though the shooting is so much fun in 2 and 3, you go there for the choices. And at the end, I think it's not just that you have this choice to make. It's that, for me, I wanted to ensure after the death I was about to experience that life would still have choice. Mm-hmm. And if I did the blue ending, there wouldn't be choice. That's just controlling the Reapers. That's not helping things, really. Maybe this immediate cycle there will be less violence, but we're controlling a whole form of life that isn't necessarily evil. Yeah. That's bad. And in the destroy option, that's horrible because you're going to wipe out the Reapers, wipe out the Geth, probably kill Edie and all this stuff. And then you're committing...
Just compared to killing... all the Reapers and the Geth, all these other effectively sentient life forms. Legion has proven that the Geth can become sentient. Yeah, Edie's the one.
Well, but
and Edie.
All I'm saying
and
is...
And R2-D2, mother. You kill fucking R2.
Well,
C3, okay, C3,
the reason I reference Edie is I think Edie is thematically tremendously important to 3. She fulfills somewhat a similar role as Igas does in 3.
Yeah. Well, Igas is way better.
Oh, Igas is way better. But it's still, it's a similar kind of thematic function.
Someone should make a mod of Mass Effect 3 that just replaces Edie with Igas.
I would pay that person so much money.
That'd be fucking awesome. I would actually go back and play Mass Effect 3 again, if that's the case.
But no, and I think I'm looking, and if you did the red ending to the destroy, you're really not giving the people much choice. You're destroying all this life, and you're ensuring that you're just basically going back to the first cycle. This will start again. I'm Shepard. I've seen this. I know what we are and what our penchants for violence and destruction are, and this isn't going to end well. Mm-hmm. This just, even if we go several, you know, 1,000 years, millennia with peace or something, it's just going to start up again, and I haven't really pushed humanity or, like, not humanity, organic life, I guess, in a direction that is beneficial to it. But with synthesis, I don't know exactly what's going to come out of that. I don't know what this new form of life will do, what choices it will make, but it will have choices because this will be unprecedented in the history of the cycles. Yeah. This truly is something new. My death will mean that in this final choice I make, there will be real freedom. There will be a real freedom from this cycle, a true step forward that no other society has been able to make. And it's scary, and it's hard to fathom, and it's, you know, tremendously intimidating. But it's the only thing I can do here that allows what I have been fighting for to really flourish, which is a future. And they repeat that phrase so much in 3. We don't just want to destroy the Reapers. We want to have a future.
Yeah.
I feel like the red and blue endings don't give you a future. They give you the past again.
Yeah.
But this is a future. And it's so fulfilling to me.
Yeah, sure. Like I'm just going to play, because obviously I also chose Synthesis, but I'm going to play the Devil's Advocate because... like, I think the destroy the Reapers is also... I totally can understand that choice, because it's like... There's sort of two different ways of looking at it, of like... And it's been 2 years since I played the game. If you do all the choices, kill Shepard no matter what, I don't remember. Synthesis definitely does.
Shepard lives in the red choice.
Okay.
There's like a little brief post-credits or something where he like starts to breathe.
Okay, so yeah. So the red one, if you choose to destroy the... not just the Reapers, but all synthetic life... like, that choice definitely makes sense to me, like and is totally, I think, defensible from even, like, a thematic standpoint of, like, of you deciding that organic life is ultimately more important than synthetic life. And I can see, especially if you're, like, a lot more sort of, like, I'm a very science-oriented person, if you're a lot more sort of spiritual, I think there's a lot more significance to the sense of organic life as compared to synthetic life, that there's something... especially special about organic life that does make it more important, and I think the destroy ending is a very American ending of, like, it's the sense of, like, human drive against all odds, that's like this pure determination that's like, come hell or high water or fucking giant synthetic robot monsters trying to destroy planets, I will stop at nothing to save the galaxy. And like, fucking the synthesis choice of, like, you have no fucking clue what comes out of synthesis choice. Like, it could be better. It could be, like, 1,000 times worse. Because you have... like you said, it's a future, but you have no idea. It is freedom. But freedom... freedom ain't free. Like, freedom's not necessarily good. Freedom probably is gonna fucking kill everybody. That's why we have America. America's not freedom. America's a fucking government. No government is free. A government is only restrictive. A government puts restrictions on things. That's literally what a government is. So... but choosing the red choice is sort of choosing to maintain the status quo, But the status quo is highly appealing because especially, and it's something that for me, because I'm going to transition now into like how I played the ending and my thoughts onto it. That'll go like a little bit further for the ending than you did. But it's like, for me, like I like was really tempted by the red choice because the whole arc of the game, especially for my Shepherd, where I've said, as I've said before on this podcast, my Shepherd, I decided I went, I made my first Shepherd was mostly Renegade and I didn't really like it. And like Mass Effect 1, I was like, eh. And then when Mass Effect 2 was coming out, I decided to make a new Shepherd, James T. Shepherd, because Kirk, yay, James T. Kirk. But and I decided, fuck it, I'm going to go all Paragon 100%, kind of like I did with KOTOR when I decided to go good side and had a lot more fun doing that way than evil. And when I went all Paragon, I ended up sort of role-playing eventually once I got to Mass Effect 2 of trying to justify all these just, like, obsessive Paragon choices of, like, this intense selflessness or sense of selflessness that my Shepherd took on, even though my Shepherd had, like, the worst possible origin story of, like, he was, like, enslaved or something, and, like when he was, like, a colonist, and his family was killed by Batarian slavers and shit, and then when he became an officer in the army, eventually, like, he was fighting against Batarians, and then his entire squad under his command got killed. So my Shepherd, up to that point, had lived a horrible life, and now he's this, like this, you know, Jesus figure, almost, and, like, how kind and caring and, like, just trying to do everything for everybody he is. And to justify that, I, like, came to this conclusion that my Shepherd was this sociopath who didn't make any true relationships with anybody in his life. All he saw was bad stuff happening and good stuff happening as he understood it because of the traumas in his life. And so, since he was able to look at everything logically as a sociopath can, he was just like, I'm just going to do good stuff because good stuff is good stuff. I don't want to do bad stuff. So he obsessively pleases everybody. He's able to manipulate people. So he's kind of creepy and bad in that way, but everything he's doing is good, so he's a good guy, ultimately. But then, like, what that kind of came to eventually with Mass Effect 3 is that, like, the events of Mass Effect 3 are so overwhelmingly stressful and emotionally intense that definitely by the time I got to the section of Mass Effect 3 where you go to Thessia and the Asari homeworld, and Liara sees Thessia burning to the ground, like, the whole planet being destroyed. And my Shepherd had, like, Liara was my romantic interest for the first game. Then the second game, he had a romantic fling with Jack, but only because Jack was super fucked up in the head. And so having a romantic, like, relationship with her was to fix her. So it was, like, further digging him into the sociopathic hole. But then coming back to Liara in Mass Effect 3 and seeing that, like, trauma she was experiencing, all of a sudden, like, I felt like there was this weird click where it was both me of just, like, how emotionally invested I was in, like, because I really like Liara as a character, and, like, seeing just how distressed she was, like seeing her whole world burn was, like, really affecting to me personally. And so that kind of leaked into my character of, like, it almost broke him and made him human again. So by the time I got to that last choice, I was going in with all this baggage of, like, fuck the Reapers, man. Fuck those things. Like, you see all the horror, the terror, the bloodshed, just the sadness and misery they have strewn across the galaxy. And you know that they have done this thousands of times before because of what you've learned about the cycles from Javik, the Prothean dude. And it's like, fuck those assholes. Like, they are the supreme galactic assholes of all time. All they do is hurt and kill and maim, and they do it in some sick sense of trying to maintain life. But all they do is actually make life horrible and cause, like, these living creatures to come to a screaming, horrible, bloody halt and just, like, fucking slam it down in order to keep the cycle going. And so coming into that, it's like, fuck those motherfucking dickheads. I want to kill all those assholes. And one of the reasons I want to kill all of them, the main reason I want to kill all of them, is because I want to have this life with Liara, and, you know, I want to, like, grow old and, like, fucking get drunk on the porch with Garrus and throw rocks at young assholes who come on our lawn, you know? It's like, Garrus was, like, my best friend. He was my fucking bro. Garrus is a cool fucking guy that I wanted to, you know, like, play video games with. Garrus was a cool dude, and Liara was, like, this beautiful, amazing woman that I would want to spend my whole life with. And so Shepherd, going into this, like, has all this, like, I want to have my life. That is why I have been fighting now. Before, it was just, I want to save the galaxy, I am Commander Shepherd, I am this hero, that is what I do. And now, seeing how much stress this, like, the imminent death put on everyone around him, it became so imminently personal to him of, like, these are my friends. These are the people I love. These are the people I care about. These are the people I have, like, fought and literally died for at one point in my life. And I'm not letting this shit happen. And then you get presented with these choices, and it's like the one, you have the destroy option, and that's really appealing because, one, you destroy all the Reapers, but it's also kind of sucks because you destroy all the Geth, and my dude had been fighting for the Geth and had backed up synthetic life as being a valid alternative form of, like, sentient life that had just as much right to live as organic. So that kind of put a damper on it, but it was also like, well, Garrus isn't synthetic, you know, Liara isn't synthetic, like... Okay, sure, like, Legion is, and he's a cool dude, and Edie is, and she's kind of cool, and Joker would be pretty pissed if she got fried, but... And I do like Joker, but, Garrus is my actual, like, BFF, so Joker's cool, but he's not that level. And if I pick Destroy, I live, and I can live with them. Because it's like, if they just live... So what? Because you don't get to experience that. So it's like, at the end, my Shepherd became intensely selfish. He became human. He became like me. It's like, yeah, I want to fucking live. I want those other people to live. But it doesn't actually matter, realistically, if those people live, if I don't. You know, because it's like, from my experience, everything stops as soon as I die. So it's like, they're alive. What the fuck do I care? I can't care. I'm dead. And so that's why that choice is so, so appealing to me. But then when you see Synthesis, and it's just like... All that Synthesis represented was, like, it's hope, and that's it. Because it's like, you have no fucking clue, because you jump into Synthesis and you're dead immediately. You have no idea what impact the choice is going to have on the galaxy, and realistically, fucker, like, that's not going to solve anything. Like, the problems that created the cycle aren't that magically going to go away just because you forced every single, like, life form to become pseudo-organic and pseudo-synthetic. Like, maybe, I guess, that breaks down that, you know, artificial bias and barrier, the galactic racism, you know, but that doesn't fix the problem that created the racism in the first place. You're just going to find someone else to be incredibly racist to. Just because we stopped being immensely racist to Irish people sometime in, like, the 1940s, doesn't mean all of a sudden we became, like, weirdly, really, like, paranoid and racist towards Russians and communists, you know? In real life, you see these biases have these swings, and so, hey, the cycle's going to, realistically, it's just going to begin again. It's going to begin with something else. But it has a chance not to. And so, like, that weird little one tiny hope that Synthesis represents is ultimately, like, kind of like, this is what we've actually been fighting for. Like, because we're all going to die, no matter what. Most of these people are probably already dead anyway. Liara and Garrus have probably been killed at this point. I don't fucking know. It's like, everybody, like, everything is burning to the ground. Everything is getting destroyed. If I blow up the Reapers and synthetic life, I don't even know if there are enough fucking humans and, like, Asari and Salarians and Turians to even repopulate the galaxy at this point, because we have been so devastated that it's like, the Synthesis represents the only choice that has any form of hope whatsoever. So, like you said, like, you have to see something a little bit outside your imminent perspective, forget about how valuable your own life is to you, and decide, like, if I'm going to die, and this is what I feel like kind of like the main point of the game is that it's like, you die no matter what. And at some point in your life, you're going to fight against it as hard as you can, and you cannot, because you will die. That is the one... Okay, it's the second absolute truth in the universe. The first absolute truth is that there are two absolute truths. But fucking death comes to everybody. It's inevitable. You cannot fight against it. The one thing you can hope to do is to make shit a little bit better for the next people that come along. So it's like, that's symbolically what that Synthesis represents to me. But to me, the absolutely most beautiful part of the Synthesis ending, and this, like, comes down to very much my very specific sort of, like interpretation of what the ending means, and this is a part where a lot of people really don't like this, and I kind of understand why, and I'm not necessarily saying that the way I interpret this is the way they meant it to be interpreted. I don't think it is, but it's just the way I felt about it immediately when I played it, so I can't kind of, like, back off of that and be like, well, it probably meant this. So what happens at the ending up to this point that we haven't talked about yet is when you pick the Synthesis ending, Shepard runs in, jumps into the beam of light, and he gets completely disintegrated. But while he's being disintegrated, you see these images of Joker is on the Normandy, and he's like, oh, something's fucking going down, and he, like, fucking, like, warps out of there using a Mass Effect drive. And another part of the ending is that all the Mass Effect drives and all that shit stops, because whatever. But, like, the Mass Effect drives, he gets the fuck out of there, the Mass Relay, and like you're disintegrating, and then it's like the Normandy like shuttle lands on this planet, this like nondescript kind of really beautiful tropical planet, and then people get out of there, and for me, I saw Liara, I saw Garrus, I saw Edie, and I saw Joker get out of that shuttle, and it's like, and you see that, and you disintegrate, and it's like, it's over, and cut the credits, and that's the end of the game. And for most people, how they looked at that sequence of events is they were really perplexed by it, because it's it feels really odd and out of place, because there's no reason that Joker should be jumping out and going to that mass relay. Like, that's, he's abandoning his post, like, he's supposed to be there fighting the Reapers, like backing up this last final assault on Earth. He has no idea that the that anything's really happening on the Crucible. He has no idea, like, that Shepard has made it to the end. And so, like, there's no reason for him to leave. And then also, like, how do all these people get back onto the Normandy? Because for me, Garrus and Liara were with me when I was sprinting to the end. So it's like, there's absolutely, like, they... Realistically, they should just be dead. Yeah,
and exactly. Actually, that informed my decision, is I assumed Garrus and Liara were dead.
Like, for me, I wasn't 100% sure, but I was like, they probably everybody else has died. Like, because you've seen just mass destruction. Like, there was, like, a couple thousand people left on the planet at the end of that fucking game. And so, it's like, all of a sudden, it's like, how did all these people get back on the Normandy? Where the fuck is this planet? And then they get out, and, like, some of them, like, they look kind of, like, synthetic-y because you did the synthesis thing. And so people looked at that, and they're like... felt that the ending was really rushed and didn't make any sense. And I've like I said, I have no idea if that's, like, if BioWare actually, like, really rushed that ending. I have no idea. Like, but my interpretation, how I felt, and like I said, like, this is immediately how I read it. This isn't, like, me going back and trying to justify it. Is I was looking at that, and the way it's cut interspersed with Shepard disintegrating into the synthesis beam and all that stuff happening, is that it made it feel to me like that is what Shepard is seeing as he is dying. That, like, he's, like, he at this point, like, he's mostly disintegrated, he's lost almost all of his, like, cognitive ability, he's fucking dying, like, immediately. In those, like, last, like, couple of seconds, he sees these flashes, these visions of what he thinks is actually happening, what he hopes is happening, which is Joker and everyone get away and land on that planet and get out and everything's fine and that you succeeded, because it's like he's so determined that that's the last vision, the flash he has. And then, but then that light goes out, and he's dead, and it cuts to credits, and you don't actually know what happens. You have no idea if that succeeded, really. Like, you don't know, like, you have no idea if Liara or Garrus survived. They probably didn't. Probably none of that shit actually happened. My interpretation is, yeah, none of that happened. Like, all those people died, definitely. Almost everybody on Earth died. A few of them maybe escaped, but most of the, like, current sentient civilizations in the galaxy were wiped out, because it's like there wasn't even enough people left to repopulate, and the mass relays got destroyed, so they couldn't even return to their planet, so they would use up all their resources and die anyway while they were still in the solar system. So everybody died. Shepard did not save the current galactic civilization at all, almost probably, but it's like that there's that beauty of him seeing it and then dying and not being able to know, because it's like it simulates that effect of death of, like, you don't get to know. Like, even if you die in the middle of serving some sort of what you believe is a righteous cause, if you die serving that cause, you have no idea how it turns out. You have no idea if you succeed. You have no idea if what you did worked. If what you did was good, you don't get to see the effects of it because you're dead. It's over. You don't get to experience anything more. Fucking cut the credits. Your time is done. And that was so beautiful to me. Like, just, like, the way it affected me, and, like, it... like I said, it really hurt, because it was like I was really heavily torn between deciding for, like, trying to maintain and live out the rest of my life with my friends and family, or trying to choose something maybe a little bit higher, something hopeful, and something that is a true middle finger to the Reapers, because it destroys everything the Reapers have actually been trying to do, because it throws a sand in their face and says, hey, fuckers, you were wrong. There is a better way to do this. So it's like,
yeah,
you have to choose. For me, it's like, you have to choose hope, even, and that's like, but the way that affected this, like, for me, this, like, kind of, like, really dark tragedy of my character of, like, regaining his humanity, regaining his investment in, like, real relationships with people, but then having to discard that ultimately for the greater good of regardless. Fucking sad shit, dude. And that's the beauty of the game, is that all of that stuff is completely personal to me in a way that, like, even, you know, obviously, like, there's, everybody has a different interpretation of every movie they see or book they read or poem they read, because we all are different and unique and bring our own experiences to it. But the way the game lets you shape that in a level so far beyond that allows you to bring your own themes to the material entirely that come from outside is something that only a video game can do, and that is why I love the Mass Effect 3 ending. It's why I haven't played any of the DLC after that, even though I've heard like the Citadel and like one of the other ones is really good and interesting. And I played it when it came out, so I didn't see the extended ending. I have no interest in seeing it because I had no problem with the ending as it existed. And it's like that experience in its own way was so traumatizing that I cannot go back to the franchise to this point. It's been 2 years since Mass Effect 3 has come out, almost. And actually, it has been past 2 years. It's getting to 3 years now. That's like, I can't go back. I can't play Mass Effect 1. I can't play Mass Effect 2. I can't play the multiplayer in 3. It's like, I can't touch that franchise anymore. I can't go back and play the DLC. It's like, because Shepard fucking died, and that's it.
So. And I agree. And I, when I played it, I didn't have the immediate reaction of that was a vision at the end. Mm-hmm. But I did have the reaction of there's something a little off here because Garrus stepped out of the ship for me, and I was 100% sure Garrus was dead. I thought, because it's very clear they come with you on that run, I thought the point was they're dead, and I was reading a lot of Shepard's actions, and my Shepard was female, so a lot of Jennifer Hale's performance as coming out of this place of, I'm all that's left, everyone I love is dead, and I have to power through anyway. And I actually would... You walked through like your specific role-playing experience to get there. I'd like to do that a little bit, too, because that definitely influenced mine, is that the way I came about doing Paragon options is that I had played 1 and 2 as Renegade, and then I went back and played the whole series again in preparation for 3. I got the trilogy set. And I played 1 as... did a lot of Renegade options. And I got to the end and did the thing where you kill the Council.
Yeah.
And I felt horrible. And I felt like I had done the worst thing I'd ever done. And I just realized, like, I had let my stupid human emotions get the better of me, and I had done something bad, and then when I died and came back in 2, I had what Sean described as my born-again Christian moment as Shepard, where I really felt like I had this second chance, I wanted to be better, I wanted to use this second chance as life, to be the person I wasn't strong enough to be before. And I had definitely... why I had always played Shepard as Renegade before was the specific choices I made at the beginning of her past. I felt like she was someone who... was good in a lot of ways, but just the way she approached getting things done was influenced by the horrors of her past. Yeah. And I felt like because she had done that horrible thing with the Council and then had this death and resurrection, I think she had seen that I have to rise above the bad things in my life. I have to rise above the person I was before, these sorts of ideas.
Instead of throwing the entire galaxy into political turmoil, maybe I should calm down a bit and look at this a little bit objectively. Yeah.
And so that really influenced, and it made 2 and 3 so much richer to me, because I was playing it with that mindset where I was Paragon because I wanted to be better, and I wanted to look for the best ways to help people and to be better. But I also had, I think, this sense that I was kind of living on borrowed time in a weird way.
Yeah.
Where throughout Mass Effect 3... and this was actually something that I almost picked up just in line. I couldn't point to the moments, but like lines of dialogue, things in Jennifer Hale's delivery, just interactions you have with people. I didn't get the feeling that Shepard was planning on living through this. I think she maybe planned on hoping others could, but I felt this very fatalistic thing to it. And I felt like, in terms of meta-text, I felt like there was something, kind of a sly, subtle commentary there that Shepard's existence is defined by your relationship with him or her as the player, and that life... really starts and ends with where you as the player came into it, and so it kind of had to end at the end of 3.
Yeah.
So I would have been very disappointed in an ending where Shepard lived, because I thought it wouldn't fulfill the kind of themes I had been seeing, even though those themes are very personal to my role-playing experience. But I got to the end, and because of that fatalistic attitude, and because I also... because of that fatalistic attitude, I was not looking for a solution where I would live or have a future. I wasn't worried about that, especially because there's that content before then where you get blown up by Sovereign or Harbinger, and you think you're dead, and you come back, and you get there, and you have Anderson, and Anderson dies next to you, and it's just such a fucking sad scene. And you think you're gonna die too, but you just, it's like, but then you're like, okay, Hackett, what do you need me to do? Because that's what Shepard is always asking, what do you need me to do?
Lance Henriksen, guide me! I need something, man!
I love Admiral Hackett. Yeah. He's so great. But anyway, you're just at, It's what do I do? And I am at the end of my borrowed time. What can I do that will make a fucking difference? Because look at this. This can't go on. And I think what I was thinking is, this cannot go on in a grand cosmic sense. And the blue is out because blue is stupid.
Yeah.
Red is out to me equally immediately, because for one, I feel just a theme in the game that Shepard would have naturally picked up on is the value of synthetic life. You have it with Edie, you have it with the Geth, you have the Quarians recognizing it. It's
yeah,
just
but that's only if you've made the choices that
you've
lead
made.
To that
and
point.
No, and I know, yeah. But I'm saying that's my Shepard. Okay. That's like my playthrough.
I thought you were saying that like the game itself was pointing you that way.
No, but on that path the game is.
Yeah.
And those choices are. But yeah, and so all these thoughts in my mind, and that I had gotten to this point where I was viewing what the Reapers were doing in my life as horrible and horrific, but them themselves as not evil, kind of understanding this kind of bigger sense of it. And also because I had had this experience where I died, came back, and decided I was going to be better, if I was going to die again, I wanted to do it in the same fashion of, can I leave a mark that is better? Or,
yeah.
And I don't know if I'm phrasing this right, but I felt like I had this responsibility of, it's more than my life. My life is kind of immaterial right now. I did horrible things once, and I've been trying to pay for them, and now I've been doing better things, but I've been doing better things not strictly for me. You know, I had a romance in the game, was Garrus, and Garrus was someone who I sort of felt attracted to in the games because he had a similar arc to my Shepard, where he is a very dark character who's kind of trying to, repent is the wrong word, but he wants to do good, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what attracted my Shepard to Garrus, I think. They were very kindred spirits in that way. And I was a Liara love interest in one, and I love Liara as a character, don't get me wrong. It was not, it wasn't her,
because
Garrus,
you couldn't bone Garrus in the first game.
Right,
so.
Yeah. But anyway, so all sort of all of these thoughts, and kind of knowing that Garrus and Liara and the rest of my crew were dead, and all of that, just sort of gave me this freedom to think, you know, what is the option that means something here for me? And it was so obviously synthesis to me, because I feel like my Shepard, in this kind of battle between good and evil inside herself, had spent this series looking for something greater, for something that is, to use a kind of overused phrase, transcendent.
Yeah.
And
transcendent,
I felt like...
transcendence.
Yes. And I felt like, you know, that synthesis ending, that was what I had been looking for. That was kind of the light at the end of the tunnel for Shepard, because that's, you know, organic life sort of finally kind of will come to terms in a certain sense with their relationship with technology.
Yeah.
And technological life like Edie will get a much closer view to organic life and stuff like that. And even more so than that, I feel like while Mass Effect 3 is very, very much on the surface about our relationship to technology, and it has a lot of things to say about that, I also think that final choice, organic versus synthetic, is very metaphorical. It's kind of about ourselves versus ourselves.
And yeah, it's like, you don't have to just be you and then your iPhone. It's like, you can be me iPhone.
No,
you know?
That's not...
You are you and your iPhone.
That's
the
not...
iPhone has rights too, motherfucker.
That's not what I'm saying. What I was saying is, I think... it's technology, these synthetic elements, they stem from us. And I think what this kind of stands for, from a moralistic, idealistic, thematic standpoint in the series to me, is, you know, the things we do in human history, in our lives, that are horrible and self-destructive, and kind of learning to subsume those and live with them in a way that doesn't lead to more self-destruction.
Yeah, for me, like, it very much looked at the organic versus synthetic as, like, this sense of, like, trying to break away from this very human arrogance of, like, what we understand, like, what our existence is the only real valid existence. And that's sort of, like, this kind of stuff that is motivated, like, fuck it. Let's just kill all the Native Americans. They're not really like us. They don't have the same style of culture. They don't have the same style of, like, technology or anything. So they're obviously inferior because they're different. So let's kill them all. And so it's like, yeah, the organic synthetic is very much like, let's break out of this, like, arrogance that we have of, like, our experience is the only valid one.
Yeah. And I really like how your explanation of the sort of vision ending, because what happened in my ending is that the first thing that happens is, on the planet at least, Joker and Edie step out of the ship. Joker has clearly become part synthetic. Edie is much more human. And I feel like Shepard would be thinking of that, because that's kind of the beauty you're searching for in that moment.
Yeah. Just Joker boning Edie. You're right. That's what... It's like, if Shepard had just managed to hang on a little bit longer, that would have been a very different ending. It would have gotten really X-rated all of a sudden.
No, but I'm just saying, it's not totally about sex, but it is about, you know, these two people who, Joker and Edie, as much as they come close in those two games, there's going to be a barrier between them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of removed, and there is this new life form, and it's something that my Shepard, you know, I'm dying, I know I will never actually see that, but I have to hope that what comes of this will be different than the cycles I've lived through and experienced. I was forged in wars. I was, you know, made bad at one point by bad things that happened to me, and then, you know, tried to be good in other ways. And this was sort of like the capper to my life's arc. And then also talking, you know, with the Catalyst and sort of seeing a lot of the ideas I'd had kind of set in stone by what the Catalyst has to say and, yeah. and this grander perspective that the Catalyst has.
Cycles, so. Motherfucker.
Yeah.
Cycles.
So anyway,
it's
but...
It's all because of bicycles. It's all their fault.
But I think this is awesome to be able to discuss yeah. this and that we both came to similar thematic conclusions from very different directions.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we made the same choice, but, like, for completely, like, not for, like, completely different reasons, but, like, yeah, we definitely,
yeah.
our shepherds were so completely different in how, in, like, their own individual thematic arcs that brought them to the conclusion of, like,
yeah.
we gotta do something, man, like, we've gotta, goddamn it, like, we can't just only destroy the Reapers, you know, like, we have to, it's, you know, it's like, if you can't just kill Batman, because that doesn't solve anything, you have to kill everything about Batman, you have to kill the symbol he represents. You can't just destroy the Reapers. If you really want to destroy the Reapers, you have to destroy the cycle. You have to destroy what the Reapers are trying to do. This is like, so either my Shepherd either was ultimately really altruistic or ultimately really vindictive. And I haven't decided which. If he was like, we have to embrace hope, or it's like, we have to completely erase the Reapers. Like, everything about them, like, fuck their technology, fuck their philosophies, fuck everything they represent, and fuck them themselves. It's all getting destroyed. All of it, motherfucker.
Yeah. No, and it's fucking crazy, and I just love that ending.
Yeah.
I love how much it's made me think, how much it's haunted me, how much it's uplifted me. I think, endings are hard, and endings,
yeah, without a doubt.
And you look at all these great long-running stories and stuff that have endings that, you know, usually, you know, I was very invested in Harry Potter as a kid and stuff, for instance, and get to that, and I think it's J.K. Rowling wrote a very good ending, but I have problems with it. Or I get to the end of Lost, and it's like, I love the Lost ending, but there's some, you know, things to hear that
I have some
perfect.
Problems with the Harry Potter ending, too, coming from the movies, because it's like the makeup sucks with that last scene where they're all
you
old.
Don't even,
it, like, looks terrible.
You never liked Harry Potter, so it doesn't...
Yeah, but the end, that doesn't mean the ending couldn't have been good.
Okay.
Or the makeup in the ending, at the very least, couldn't have been believable. Old
anyway,
Harry looked, I don't know, looked terrible.
But I'm just thinking of various long-running stories that have meant a lot to me, and I can't think of anything that quite matches Mass Effect in terms of nailing it to me, just nailing it.
I'm trying to think of like other really long running. I mean, obviously, like Doctor Who has not ended. They're still making Spider-Man comics, so my longest running stuff hasn't ended yet.
Star Wars, for instance, Return of the Jedi is great,
sure.
But Ewoks.
But
shit,
even
you know?
Then, that doesn't like you're comparing like something that's like Mass Effect. The whole trilogy is like 80 to 90 hours long,
right.
Compared to like Star Wars is like 9 hours long. If
right.
you combine all of them.
But I'm just saying different things that you know you watch over a course of time or experience. And with Mass Effect, I think what really pushes it over the edge is it's not just an ending that feels so perfect to me. It's one that makes me like the entire series more in retrospect.
Yeah.
It contextualizes it in a way that just solidifies that franchise as brilliant to me.
Yeah, yeah. And it's such, like I said, like it's such a perfect ending that I can't engage with the material anymore.
No, I can't either.
In a good way.
I was planning on playing some multiplayer. I'm never going to play Mass Effect 3 multiplayer because I put it back on the shelf and I'm like, I have to be done with this for now. And it'll live on in my mind.
The Mass Effect 3 multiplayer is actually surprisingly really good when I play
it.
Like, I haven't played it since, obviously, but when I played it, it was, this is actually really cool.
And I'll say this, too, I want to mention is I had a lot of problems with Mass Effect 3 going through it.
It definitely has its flaws. I'm not going to, it's a perfect game.
Not narratively necessarily, because I think story-wise, it's by far the best in the series. And I think it's probably got, to me, it has easily the highest highs character and story-wise.
Yeah, I mean,
all the
because
stuff.
Because everything's been building up
it.
Like, there's just some of those, like, one of my most fun things to do with Mass Effect 3 is the only way I've gone back to it in any way was after it came out. I went on YouTube and, like, watched how certain other things could play out.
It's so crazy. It's so
like,
crazy.
Like, watching, like, Tally, like for you, did you manage to have both Tally and Legion live?
Oh, Legion died because he sacrificed himself.
No, Tally and Legion both lived in my playthrough.
Oh, really? How does
that's
that
how,
work?
That's how fucking Paragon I am, motherfucker. I saved everybody, and then everybody fucking died. That's how bad it is. That, like, for my playthrough, I mean, Morden dies because you can't avoid it. Well,
right.
You can, but, like, you have to
only
do other,
by fucking everyone else.
Yeah, only by doing other bad shit. But it's like, everybody I could have feasibly saved, I saved everybody! And then, like, everyone dies, and it's like, well, fuck! Shit!
Yeah.
It's not easy to get that situation to come out as both Tally and Legion surviving.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't met anybody else that got that to happen for them.
Oh, wow.
I don't know specifically what I did. Like, I know, I'm pretty sure you have to do, like, you have to be super fucking paragon. There are some very specific choices you have to make.
I was pretty sure Legion had to die just because his death scene is so fulfilling. It's like
all those death scenes are. Like, when I watched them on YouTube, and it was just like, oh my god.
But, like, I will say, like,
sad, and it's, like, so perfect, but sad yeah. in its own way.
Up until the last probably 3 hours of Mass Effect 3, my favorite stuff in that game was the T'Chanka material, mm-hmm. because I just love how great a leader Rex has become.
Yeah.
I love how, you know, happy Grunt is to see you when you first go to meet him and all the Rachni stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And then coming back to, you know, the cure of the Genophage and everything, I just feel like it's so fulfilling, this idea of hope, everyone coming together, and Morden dies, but I don't, and I feel sad because I love Morden, but at the same time, that is the most meaningful death Morden could ever achieve. Because, you know, he's at the end of his life anyway, he's an old yeah. Salarian. And I think you get this sense through talking with him that he's not really going to be happy outside of this sort of wartime scenario, you know, investigating seashells and stuff.
Yeah, and that, like, there's almost a sense that, like, he has to die in order to fix the Genophage. It's mm-hmm. like, that was such, that was his problem that he basically caused, because he was one of the primary scientists and engineers behind it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, he, like, the Genophage had to die with him. Like, yes. It was inevitable.
But all of that just, God, like, I think I had a couple, you know, hours left I could have played that night, but I just, after Morden died, I had to, it was like when a friend dies or something, it's like, I had to just kind of take my time to grieve.
And yeah, then, but for me, like, the Legion one, just watching it all, I mean, Tally's is really rough, because she kills herself, she jumps off the fucking cliff, which is like, but it's also, like, beautiful in its own way, because it's like the first time she's ever set foot on her own homeworld, and she, like, takes off her mask and all that shit, but, like, Legions is the one that hits me the hardest, because he has one of my favorite lines in the whole series, where he's just like, looks at her and he's like, "Talizora, does this unit have a soul?"
It's just like, I love it.
Oh my god, dude, that's like, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard anyone say.
Well, that's
like, holy shit, man.
That's an interesting case where the Corian Geth stuff I don't love as much as the T'Chanka stuff, because I think it's a pretty clunky part of the game gameplay wise. But when you get to that last couple cutscenes,
God.
You fight the Reaper, and then just, God, what happens with Legion? And just, I love that, yeah, Legion has so many heartbreaking scenes there, but he manages to elevate his whole species, and then the Quarians and Geth get to live together, they get to learn from each other.
Yeah.
You know, Tali gets to come back to her homeworld, she takes the mask off, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Just so beautiful. And yeah, and so my whole point with Mass Effect 3 is, and maybe I'll talk about some of my problems in a little bit. I had a lot of problems with the game here and there, but that ending hit so hard, it
renders all the problems basically irrelevant.
Oh yeah.
Like while I was playing it, sure, I have criticisms and I can bring them out here, but it's like, in my memory, they're all irrelevant. It's almost kind of like with Persona 3, how it's like, now, like, while I was playing it, I had a lot of problems with it, but after you finish the whole game, like, I just look back on the thing in its totality, I'm like, fuck it, dude. Like, it's perfect to me. Like,
well,
it's not perfect, but it's perfect. Like, I don't care.
Although I will say, Persona 3 is a slightly different case, where I feel like the Persona 3 last couple hours contextualized.
It's a little bit, like, they're, Mass Effect 3 has some, like, very specific issues that, like, things that they could have done much better.
I'll say them right now.
Okay, sure.
I really disliked a lot of the level design. I thought it was tremendously unclear where you were supposed to go most of the time.
I don't think I had a huge problem. I mean, I didn't enjoy the missions as much as I did in 2, but yeah, I didn't have a huge problem with that.
I thought level design was problematic. Yeah. I thought combat was probably even more polished than it was in 2, but the actual combat scenarios were often clunky and not as
Mass
fun.
Mass Effect 2 had better mission designs.
Well, and this is what I'll say, like, in terms of mission and level design, is Mass Effect 3 does a ton of that. Go hit 2 buttons.
Yeah,
on one side of the map, on the other. I hate that. I hate it in Halo 4. You've heard me rant about this before.
That one level in Halo 4 is like that to like the nth degree.
Right. And Mass Effect 3 is a lot of go hit 2 or 3 or 4 buttons. And I don't like that. And I feel like 2 was so much more organically challenging. It had such better, like, it was so dynamic. The levels never felt stagnated in any way. I mean, Mass Effect 2 is a perfect fucking game. It's just, that game is, that defines polish in video games to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas 3, I feel, is kind of clunky in some areas. I also thought my biggest problem, hands down, with 3 was Mass Effect 2, one of its biggest improvements over 1 is that 1 had a lot of kind of side missions that never felt like they cohesively meant anything, whereas 2 pared it down, and while it had side quests and stuff, all of them had weight, purpose, meaning.
Yeah, and they had their own interesting little stories and stuff to them that were a lot easier to follow, where the Mass Effect 1 side missions were like, I'm on this random planet, and it's like, oh, this kind of weirdly ties into this other, like, research facility I found on one planet, like, 15 hours ago.
Right.
It's so hard to, like, piece those together, whereas, like, Mass Effect 2, it's like, you're kind of following this, like, a rogue AI, like, from, like, it fucking up all these droids to, like, back to where it originated
right.
from.
And Mass Effect 2 is also a game where you can very feasibly do every single thing there is to do in the game because it's just so well organized in your journal. You
yeah.
always know what you're supposed to do. You can very feasibly find everything, and everything you do you feel like has weight in your overall mission.
Yeah.
But then Mass Effect 3, it's not a problem until you get to post the Citadel invasion by Cerberus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 Citadel fetch quests. And they are
definitely
all,
not that many. But
there's at least 40. There's so fucking
there's
many.
There's definitely not 40.
There are. There's a lot. There's a
yeah,
ton
there's,
of
but
these.
There's definitely not
there
40.
Are, there
that
are
would be,
dozens of them. It's crazy.
There's probably. I'd put it cap 25.
Okay, you,
there's probably
there's
a lot less
more.
Than that,
there's but. Way more than 25. I counted these out. There's way more than 25.
I mean, across the whole game, there's like that many fetch missions, but
okay.
not just like that section.
No, but you just you get. I mean, you're walking around and they yeah. just pop up with no context whatsoever. The
yes,
journal,
this is the worst part of the game.
Your journal tells you almost nothing to do about what to do. Most of it is just you go out into space and you scan things and you go walk around the Citadel again and the journals it'll just fulfill itself.
Yeah.
But it's just super annoying. It's not well organized. It's even worse than Mass Effect 1 in that way. In
yeah.
terms of mission design, it's just a fucking mess. And then also, and then I felt like in that section, because I think why I had so many Citadel fetch quests and stuff was I think they were carryovers from previous Citadel sections that I just
sure,
hadn't
yeah.
done yet.
Like you hadn't done like any of them. I could
right.
see why it would be because I was doing them as I was playing the game.
Okay, and I just had because and I guess I felt like there was a sense of urgency where I don't need to do these things
yeah.
right now, so I'm going to wait. And I, there never was a real good point to do them. But after
yeah.
the second after the Cerberus invasion. It felt like I had some time, so I took an evening and was trying to do them all. And after about 3 hours of doing random fetch quests and trying to figure out what to do and often not being able to figure out what to do without going online and looking it up because your journal tells you shit in Mass Effect 3.
Yeah.
It's just I realized I wasn't having fun with the game anymore because what was fun with Mass Effect 3 was all the story-oriented stuff. These had no story push.
Yeah.
I was going to go back and do the story, and I was much happier after I did that. And eventually what I did is I took 2 hours, listened to a podcast, scanned absolutely everything in
yeah.
the galaxy, then went back to the Citadel, talked to absolutely everyone in the Citadel, and I got most of the fetch quests done. But it just it's a super annoying, clunky system, and it's such a regression from what 2 had, and that bothered me.
Yeah, like for me... I don't think it bothered me as much as it did you, but mostly probably because, like I said, I like metered it out while I was playing the game, so as I like got them, I did them. But yeah, no, it is definitely the worst part of the game, and it's something that like is tricky, like thinking about like trying to like fix it of like because you want to have side stuff, you know, you don't want like absolutely everything to just be the main story mission.
But here's
like
a good example. I think they do some side stuff in 3 that's really good and feels like what they would have done in 2, like when you talk to Arya T'Loak and you have to go unite the mercenary bands on the Citadel.
Mm-hmm.
That feels like a much more substantive side quest that
okay.
you don't have to do, but it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of them, but like what I was going to say was that the main problem with, and I think even those ones have this issue, and it's a problem with Mass Effect 3 that is difficult for me to mentally try to solve, is that the main story puts so much pressure on you and has such a massive sense of urgency. Because the game starts out with Earth getting fucked in the ass by the Reapers. Like just completely getting absolutely demolished, and the Reapers are just destroying everything. And so, and that's like the first, 2 hours of the game is just watching that happen to Earth and then leaving. And then all the rest of the game is watching that successively happen to more and more planets that are the homeworlds of all your other friends. And so it's like there's this intense urgency of like we have to get this shit done and we have to get it done right now. And this is a problem that a lot of open world games have. But Mass Effect has it. Mass Effect 3 has it in spades of like if there is that much urgency to do everything right this fucking instant, because every second you don't spend trying to stop the Reapers is another second that a million other sentient life forms just got vaporized. And that's like the scale of the tragedy is so immense. That's like doing any of the side stuff just feels out of place. Like almost regardless of what it is, doing anything that does not directly and immediately contribute to the efforts of fighting the Reapers just feels bizarre and out of place to you because of the pacing of the game and the sense of urgency it has. But it's a video game and it's a big kind of open world RPG video game. So you want to have that other stuff there, but it also breaks the flow at the same time.
I guess so, but I even then I feel like they could have pared down on the number of
things. Oh no, I'm not saying that that side mission stuff, that kind of like the fetch quest stuff, was not also poorly implemented on top of it, but it is also part of like a much bigger problem that Mass Effect 3 has that I don't think any other game has actually solved yet, of how to fix this sense of urgency but also allow a lot of player freedom, you know?
Yeah, and I can see that, and I think the one thing that almost saves it in some parts is that you have your war assets counter.
Yeah.
And so you do feel good when you go scan a planet and get
a
war asset.
A little bit, but it's like that's so artificial and just like non-contextualized of like, I found this religious artifact of the Hanars on this random backwater piece of shit planet that I was looking for because while I was walking on the Citadel, I happened to hear two Hanars talking about it. I didn't engage in conversation with the Hanars. I eavesdropped, heard it in passing, decided, oh, they're missing this religious artifact in some backwater piece of shit planet. I guess I'll go find that. Then you go find it, come back. Those Hanars are having the same conversation that they've been having for presumably like weeks because you just went traveling across space. And then you go and just like, here's your religious artifact. Please say thank you. I'm like,
well, that's actually
thanks, you creepy, crazy motherfucker that just like heard our conversation and went out and grabbed it and gave it to us.
Yeah, and that's actually a problem I have with a lot of the game is they change some of the mechanics so that you very rarely, it feels like, actually talk to someone in this classic Mass Effect style.
Yeah.
You usually just initiate, they talk, and you can walk and ignore them.
Yeah.
And it's usually, it doesn't bother me for sort of some of that kind of stuff, but some of this, I wish more of the Normandy conversations, some of them are really fascinating, and I wish they were face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of the stuff Garrus and Liara say is so well-written, I wish it wasn't, I can walk out of this room and just ignore it.
Yeah, that's definitely true of, like, it's part of, like, it definitely, like, Mass Effect 3 has a little bit, like, behind it that does make it feel a little bit rushed, which is definitely why I understand people's complaints about, like, that one aspect of the ending where it's like, these scenes just feel so out of place and bizarre.
Here's something we haven't said about the ending that I want to mention.
Sure.
We played the original vanilla ending.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it wasn't even, the extended one was not when I played it.
And I looked at some of the, I read about it, didn't watch the scenes because I was still too raw then, but I read about the extended cut editions and I really don't like them. I think ambiguity is so key to how I read that ending.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's too crucial because you couldn't have your, it's a vision ending with the extended cut. It adds too much there. Like, they have a funeral for Shepard.
Oh.
They do all the, you know, they go back into space somehow and stuff. Like, that all happens in the extended cut.
Like, the one thing I know about the extended cut ending is that it adds another possible ending where you're talking to the Star Child kid and you're just like, fuck this. Just fuck all your choices. Just fuck all this shit. We're just gonna fight. Like, whatever, dude. Fuck you.
Yeah.
This is all bullshit. Which I kind of, I don't know how it actually plays out in the game, but just hearing that that's there, it's like, I like the idea of that. I like the idea of that ending. I'm just like, nah, fuck this.
What happens is that you kill him, the Reapers destroy all organic life, and the cycle continues.
Yeah.
But then it does a scene after the credits where someone finds Liara's, like, box of information.
Oh, that's a good touch.
And then the next cycle wins, I guess, is what happens. Which seems
weird. If no cycle can win, like if you just, like I said, you just jump into a brand new cycle, motherfucker. It's
right.
All just shit and misery, no matter what.
Yeah,
that's what my expect.
But I like the Shepard goes insane ending. But no, and it's just
fuck you.
The extended cut really, to me, everything I read was just BioWare made a checklist of things people didn't like and put them. It's just it's fan service. The ending, and it's stupid.
Yeah.
And I really wish they had a little more creative integrity there, because...
But, like, I mean, but you weren't, like, you hadn't played the game, so you, I don't think you were fully aware of just how cacophonous that outrage was.
It was
intense.
Yeah.
Like, especially, like, as someone who played and actually really liked the ending, it was almost scary. Like, it was, there was so huge, and, like, so many people just, like, screaming on the internet. It was just, like, what the fuck? I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
That level of outrage. I'm like, about anything. Like, you know, like, we're having, like, conversations about whether or not to bomb fucking Syria. And nobody really gives a shit. Like, people don't like the ending to Mass Effect 3. Like, I think if I said my opinion about the ending out loud, someone would fucking shoot me. It was like, that's how crazy it was.
Right. I was aware of it to the degree I could be aware of it, in that people are doing petitions and suing and what the hell's going on. And
yes! Like, what exactly? What the fuck? And it's almost like, and now being, like, you know, years out from it, I actually really like that there was that much backlash, because it was like, it makes the ending almost magical in this like weird way of like, if everyone had just kind of liked the ending, nobody would talk about it anymore. Because it's like, oh yeah, that was kind of good. You know, like, it's like the ending to Halo 3. It's like, yeah, that's a good ending for that game. But it's not like anyone's like, no, fuck the ending to Halo 3. Or like, the ending to Halo 3 is the greatest thing that ever happened. But like, that massive backlash to Mass Effect 3 was just like, now it makes the game like unforgettable. Like, it is now, like, that game right. is now an event cemented in video game history. Is now a discussion, is a thing that gets brought up in discussions about, like, artistic integrity and like, how much fan choice and fan, like, influence can be allowed in a video game product that has choice as one of its major mechanics in it, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing the extended cut does, I was going to mention, that was antithetical to my yeah. interpretation, was it makes clear the mass relays were just damaged, not destroyed. Yeah. And to me, that is so crucial, because yeah. I feel like part of the freedom you're giving is unshackling them from prior civilizations, yeah. and the mass
yeah,
relays
like
are...
Like I said, like, you have to have just all of it. You have to destroy all of it to get
right.
rid of Reapers.
Because you also get... It's the Citadel and the mass relays are the two big pieces of Reaper tech you've been using.
Yeah, and that is how the cycle operates, is that you're entirely reliant on
right.
this technology that you do not in any way understand.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, you have to completely break from that.
Mm-hmm.
Find out your own way to fucking achieve faster than light travel, assholes.
Right.
Stop stealing ours.
Exactly. So, yeah. But I love Mass Effect 3. I think I focused on some of the negatives. Positives for 3, beyond what we've already mentioned,
yeah.
is, good fucking God, the scale of this game.
Yeah,
crazy. And actually, it's kind of funny, because I think Mass Effect 3 is proof of why we need next-gen consoles desperately at this point,
yeah.
because they had to, just by virtue of the story they're telling, increase the number of assets on screen exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so the scale is just mind-boggling. Like, when
yeah.
you're on Tuchanka and you're fighting, you're trying to get to the two buttons you have to push to activate
yeah.
the thing, which, it's a two-button mission, but I still really like it, because just Reapers are... That Reaper is pouring
yeah.
down on you, and then the fucking Thrasher Maw fights it, and it's like...
Oh, yeah. That's
it's great.
Awesome.
That's like Pacific Rim level
yeah, like
of...
the mother of
yeah.
all Thrasher Maws fighting
yep.
the Reaper. Yeah.
But the
great.
Sacrifice they had to make is graphical fidelity, to me, looks much lower than it did in 2. Textures
sure,
aren't
yeah.
as clean. There's a lot more macro blocking and cutscenes, things like that. It just doesn't look as detailed and colorful and good to me, or deep and rich,
mm-hmm.
I guess. And I see why, because you can't have it both ways if
yeah.
you're on current gen tech. But I feel like if they had made that game, let's say for the PS4, it would have been like too much visually for your eyes to
yeah.
handle, you know?
Although, like, one thing I will say about Mass Effect 3 is, I think, like, the spectacle aspect of it, definitely, like, you know, like you said, like, when the mother of all Thrasher Maws fights the Reaper, that's just like, that's fucking awesome. But then also, sort of like, in terms of like graphics, I think the vistas and sort of like the skyboxes and what
oh, they're
goes
so
on
much
in the
better.
Background
yeah.
is so beautiful, but like, it's also so horrible, because all of it is like, oh, here's this beautiful, immense alien city on the surface of Thessia, the capital of the Asari, you know, the most cultured civilization in the galaxy, and just the Reapers are completely destroying it. There's like lasers, and the sky is red with fire.
Well, you know what?
But it's like, it's so beautiful. It's like they're paintings.
Right, and what hit me most was when you're on the Palavin moon, and you see Palavin burning
yeah.
in the sky. That was just too much to take, you know? I forgot
like,
to
hey, Garrus, how does it feel when your planet is burning, asshole?
Garrus was nice to me. He's like, I'm so sorry about Earth, Shepard.
Yeah,
and
I was just joking.
Yeah, I know. But,
me and Garrus were
right.
bros, so we give each
yeah.
other shit. But we don't really mean it.
Yeah. So yeah, Mass Effect 3, I want to make it clear, overwhelmingly, it's a phenomenal game.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just got some issues. And I forgot to mention one of my biggest issues with it.
Sure, what?
I want to find the person who invented Kai Lang and wring their throats.
Yeah,
I don't like that. I don't like that character. I don't like his narrative function. I don't think he fits with the Mass Effect universe. And most of all, it means we get a bunch of terrible third-person shooter boss fights that are unbelievably awful to me. They're just
wretched.
I
don't think the boss fights were that bad. Like, it's not...
Here's
I mean,
problem.
They're not good, but they're not on the scale of, like, classic bad boss fights, like some Arkham, like the Joker fight in Arkham Asylum, just like, what the fuck is
no,
this?
No, not quite on that level, but I think we've talked about this before, and I know you agree with me. I think boss fights in shooters are stupid.
Yes,
and they shouldn't be there.
You have not played the end of Half-Life 1. You have no idea how stupid boss fights and shooters can be. You haven't shot a giant floating baby like fetus monster in its open skull yet with a rocket launcher. Don't you talk to me about stupid shooter boss fights.
I'm still going to, because here's what I'll say about the Kai Lang ones, is there's three of them, and this is another one I hate, where boss fights are, like, scripted and unwinnable.
Yeah.
So the first two Kai Lang boss fights are unwinnable, scripted, you can only do a certain amount, and then it's all artificial challenge because it's so set in stone. And then the third one, to me, is even worse because it won't let you win until a certain point, so you actually kind of have to get into the mindset of, it actually doesn't matter what I do to Kai Lang until we get through these couple of waves,
mm-hmm.
because he's not affected by it.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. It's such artificial challenge. And I don't think the Mass Effect 2 end boss fight is phenomenal by any means, but I think it is a real,
It's
genuine,
better.
It's down-to-earth challenge. It's good. It
feels organic.
It feels very organic. Yeah.
And that's like bad boss fights. And I definitely think the Kai Lang fights are bad boss fights.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you can tell a bad boss fight when it's just like, feels like it came out of fucking nowhere. And it doesn't even feel like you're playing the same game anymore. And all of a sudden you have to think about, like, okay, like, how did the designer design this boss fight? Like, what's the trick? It's like, okay, like, there, he's really heavily telegraphing, like, this, like, orange thing over here. So I probably have to shoot that when he's near it or something. And, like, it completely takes you out of the mindset of how you normally play the game. It's just like, it you could just, I don't know, like, you can play 5 seconds of a bad boss fight and just be like, yeah, fuck this. Like, this is just, it's like the Tartarus fight at the end of Halo 2. It's like, what is, this just feels so arbitrary. It's not, like, building on any sort of lessons about how to play the game that you've introduced before. It just comes out of nowhere, and you have to play the game completely differently than how you used to play it, you know? It's
just,
bad boss fights are dumb.
I agree, and, yeah, Mass Effect 2's boss fight doesn't bother me in the slightest. It's not as fun as other parts, but it's not a bad boss fight.
Yeah. And I mean, the worst thing about Kai Lang was, I feel like, did we talk about this on the last podcast? I feel like I talked about this at some point, of bringing in the Expanded Universe characters into... Oh yeah, because I was talking about Assassin's Creed 3, that's where
I brought it up.
You bring in Expanded Universe characters into your mainline fiction. Assassin's Creed 3 did it with, like, the one Russian assassin dude who just gets his unceremonious death. Halo 4 did it by having the Didact be the main villain, even though they don't address anything about the Didact, they have him being introduced effectively in, like, these Forerunner precursor novels. And so it's like, the Didact's just there. And in this, Kai Lang, I haven't read the novels, but I've heard he's from Expanded Universe
That's
Mass Effect
stupid.
Novels. So it's just like, why? God damn it, games! Stop doing this! Like, hopefully, that's done. Like, hopefully, because they are all kind of from around the same period, so it's like, hopefully we've contained this weird, like, on, like, a graph where it's like you just have this inflection point of, like, where they meet, where it's like Expanded Universe story and then, like, end of trilogy or something meets to be perfect, just like, yeah, let's just drop this Expanded Universe character into our mainline fiction. But it, like, doesn't satisfy either party, because it's like the Expanded Universe character that you might like in the Expanded Universe is not served well at all by suddenly being dropped into this other medium, this other fiction, and he's just, like, kind of, like, wasted there if you're a fan of that character. Or, if you don't know anything about the character, all of a sudden, this weird guy who doesn't quite fit just comes out of nowhere. Like, there's clear there's more to this person, but they don't address it at all, and he's just there, and you kill him, and it's like, what the fuck was he?
And it's just like, the worst thing about Kai Lang for me also is that, Expanded Universe or no, he doesn't feel like a Mass Effect character to me.
Yeah.
He feels like something out of a...
Yeah, he's a fucking space ninja dude.
Right.
Like, what the fuck is that?
It doesn't make sense for Mass Effect, and he just appears over and over again, and it's just... And luckily, I think the game over, they still do great emotional stuff around him, like the Citadel invasion and then Thane dying. All the stuff with Thane there is tremendous.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the other strengths of 3, is working in all the past characters generally in ways that work really, really well. The only one that didn't hit, like, land for me was the way they brought back Jacob.
Yeah,
I thought that was shoehorned in. But
just like... Yeah, like, the Jacob one's just really weird, because you just kind of run into him, and he has, like, a wife or something now.
Sort of, but he can't really tell her he loves her, and you have to, It's not, that mission is fun, but it's just not, doesn't really work. And then he just stands in line at the hospital.
Yeah.
So, but no, I liked, and even if there is this kind of sense of, man, I am running into all these people I know in this massive galaxy.
Yeah,
I just happen to keep running into past crewmates, but it works so well every
time. Yeah, it's definitely, like, it's another one, like, a problem I would say that Mass Effect 3 has, of that, like, at some point it definitely feels shoehorned in, but it's really easy to excuse because it's like, I don't care. Like, I want to see all these characters.
Right.
And at some point, it's like, there's no way to make that feel natural at some point, because it's like, you're dealing with characters you've left off in, like, Mass Effect 1 that all of a sudden you run into again. It's like, oh, hey, you're the one dude that I met that one time. It's like, fuck it, I don't care. Let's just hang out. Like, let's have a conversation. What the fuck's been going on? That, like, this is the last of this trilogy. We're never going to have another opportunity to do this again. So let's get out of the way.
Yep. So, no, I mean, it is a very, 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 very good game. Damn. Great game, even. Narratively, as just about as good as any game I've ever played. Especially when you view it as the whole trilogy.
Yeah.
And, definitely. You know, it's... I love it to death. And if I were... You know, we did our top 10 video games podcast, and then I finished some games I wanted to put on there. So if I had to revise my rankings really quick...
Sure.
I would probably go 3 being Persona 4, 2 being Mass Effect Trilogy, and 1 being Persona 3.
Is that exactly what mine was? I'm trying to remember.
No, your 4 was Persona 4 for you. 3 was something else. I forget what 3 was for you. It was either KOTOR or Ocarina of Time. It was
probably KOTOR, yeah.
Yeah. But... And that I'm not sure about Mass Effect Trilogy versus Persona 4, but good God, the whole game of Mass Effect 3 and then the ending in particular, just because here's the thing, Mass Effect 3's ending is kind of the good version of the Persona 4 ending. It's when you talk to the god, and instead of saying we're gonna beat you,
it's just something that I think. Like, in general, Western forms of storytelling are just a lot better at handling, whereas, like, Eastern forms of storytelling do the character stuff, like, in character-based endings much better in general than we do, where it's like, we like our cold, philosophical, like, sci-fi, like, cycles, man, where it's like, man, when you get to that point, it's just like, but I've been giving you everything you wanted, like, I'm granting you this world that you desire, it's like, fuck you, man, we believe in the truth, like, we're a bunch of teenagers, and we're gonna beat you up, and it's like, I'm trying to engage you in some sort of philosophical discussion. We are discussing the future of all of humanity and what is the nature of, like, true desire and what is the truth, really, and what does it mean to people. It's like, well, I'm going to cut you with my magic Pokemon.
Yeah.
Whatever, fuckers. I'm a god.
Well, I will say the difficulty in that ranking for me is that Persona 4, from a gameplay mechanic standpoint, is fucking perfect in the Golden, at least. And so, and whereas... I think Mass Effect 2 is at that level, but 1 and 3 decidedly are not for me. And so Persona 4 might jump ahead to number 2. I'm not sure on that. Rankings are arbitrary, whatever. They're very hard to compare. But, you know, if I... And again, I was very happy with Mass Effect 2 was on that countdown, and I still think very clearly it is the best game in that series.
Yeah,
Mass Effect 3 has higher highs. It also has much lower lows in some ways. And I think I could see myself going back and playing 2 again with, like, a different Shepard just for fun, because it's such a fun game gameplay-wise. Like, I just love playing missions in 2 and the shooting. And you know, I have very conflicted feelings about the subtle ways they change combat in 3, where I think, like, the enhanced cover systems is in some ways an improvement, but then I also think they don't use it particularly effectively because the level design isn't all that great to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in 2, 2 is not as refined in terms of having so much you can do in the third-person way, but it's built completely around the mechanics that are there, and it feels complete. The other thing 3 does is I think 3 over-relies on certain shooter shooter conventions, like
like Comic-Con or PAX.
No,
conventions.
No, conventions like get on a turret and do a on-rail sequence.
Yeah, turret sequences, yes. The bane of my existence when I play shooter games.
I
fucking hate turret sequences. Can we be done with that?
And honestly,
going into the next generation, we have a clean slate. If fucking Call of Duty Ghosts has a goddamn turret sequence in it, I will go to Infinity Ward and I will sick your goddamn dog on you and make it eat you, because fuck turret sequences! I am done with that shit. I'm so done.
I am
with
too.
Scripted, dumb turret sequences. They've never been good, and they just keep on getting worse.
And I do think Mass Effect 3 gives in to shooter conventions like that a bit too much. Yeah, like, while the enhanced cover system is good in some ways, having all the rolling and then the grenades and the grenade indicator doesn't feel like Mass Effect to me. It feels like Call of Duty, and I don't need it in Mass Effect. And I guess I liked the simplicity of 2, and that just 2 is so focused on its main gameplay mechanics, and I think 3 is a little overly busy.
Yeah, like, for me, I think part of it, like, I have a different opinion on it, because while I was playing Mass Effect 3, I definitely played quite a bit of the multiplayer. And in the multiplayer, the combat is a lot more focused, so you don't get this issue of, like, is it the combat design why I'm not enjoying this, or is it the level and mission design? And I definitely think the Mass Effect 3 combat is superior to the Mass Effect 2.
Okay.
Particularly, I think playing as someone who uses powers is a lot more fun in Mass Effect 3, because the way they add in, like, biotic combos and stuff like it allows a little more versatility, and it makes you feel more effective and powerful without having to rely on guns all the time. Like, you can kill everybody by, like, mixing together your biotic powers if you really wanted to.
Well, I should have mentioned that because I completely agree with that. I play Adept. I play all powers.
Yeah.
And I really like that in 3. So, and then again, I have the disadvantage of not playing the multiplayer and kind of seeing the combat on its own, but...
Yeah, but I definitely feel the and I think the my favorite little touch that Mass Effect 3 brings to the combat system is stripping away that dumb artificial, like, I'm an adept, so I can't use an assault rifle or sniper rifle or shotgun. All I can use is a pistol or a submachine gun. Even though I am a commander in the fucking military, I should be heavily trained to use any of these firearms. Instead, it takes a much more organic of, like, you can equip any weapon you want that you have. Like, I could be an adept and I could go in fully loaded to the fucking teeth. I could have a shotgun, a sniper rifle, an assault rifle, a submachine gun, and a fucking pistol, and just go in and wade through combat that way if I wanted to. But it puts in a restriction on the more weapons you have, and different weapons have different values for this. It sort of has an encumbrance system of, like, the more it has, the longer your power cooldowns are. So if you want to have an assault rifle and be an adept, that I like to, because you unlock the ability to get an assault rifle in Mass Effect 1, regardless of what you are. So I, like, kind of had an assault rifle most of the time with my adept character. So I was like, okay, he's kind of an assault rifle dude. So you can have the assault rifle, you just take a little bit of a hit to your cooldown, or you could just go in with the pistol and just, like, all you do is use your powers. And I think that adds a lot of very organic versatility in how you approach the combat, instead of this, like, really harsh, you're adept, so you use powers and pistols, and that's it. It's like, well, come on, like, that doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Yeah, and I'll admit, I resisted that mechanic at first because it's very different than the prior games.
Yeah.
But once I saw kind of the reasoning behind it and was able to use it more effectively, I really like that idea. Yeah. I think it's a good one. I think, I like the interface of it too, and kind of going in and it's a much more complex system than 2 has for weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's justified.
Yeah, I definitely think it needed, because I think in a lot of ways Mass Effect 2 was maybe a little bit too pared down. Whereas, like, Mass Effect 1 was, like, excessively complex with, like, just, like, all the different kinds of weapons and the modifications you could get. That was just ridiculous. And the inventory was super cluttered and everything. And you just had all these powers that just, like, what's the point in throw really do? Like, you need, like, 10 points in throw to any feel any difference about it. Then Mass Effect 2 went, like, super far the other direction, where it's, like, you get, like, whatever weapons you're given, and then it's, like, you get, like, an upgrade throughout the game. And that's kind of it. And it's, like, okay, well, that's not really a whole lot. And then Mass Effect 3... you have a lot more different selections for each weapon that you encounter along the way. And then also you have, like, different modifications you could put on it that, like, add scopes and shit like that. That I think, like, added a lot more of, like, okay, I can kind of customize to the way I want to play, like I could Mass Effect 1, but while having the Mass Effect 2 combat system.
Yeah. But I'll say the key difference between 2 and 3 for me overall, holistically, is that when I think back to 3, I think back to the story and character stuff, and I'm like, my fucking God, that was great. And when I think back to 2, I think of that and all the fun gameplay times I had.
Yeah.
Because there's really no stretch of 2 that isn't just fun.
Yeah,
at the same time as being really deep and insightful and smart and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely both agree that Mass Effect 2 is easily the best trilogy on its own.
I think 2 in terms of... I think 2 is the best game of this generation to me in terms of, like, American... made games on these consoles.
I might not go quite that far. I mean, it's definitely up there, but I wouldn't jump.
Well, it was at number 2 on my list, so that's
okay. Sure.
And the other 2 for me are Persona 3 and 4, which are they came out during this generation, but I think they were on prior gen hardware, so you know, and they're very hard to compare to because they are very Japanese games.
Yes, they're completely different.
Yeah. So, but no, Mass Effect 2 kind of hands down to me is that has that title. Although I think you would have games like The Last of Us kind of challenging it, but.
I would probably say The Last of Us is better in that regard, but...
Okay. And I think Last of Us has the advantage of telling a complete story, obviously.
Yeah.
But boy, 2 just feels polished. And The Last of Us feels about as polished as a game can, also.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And being Last of Us is doubly amazing because it's an original IP and everything, you know. That's just going from scratch and making perfection. It's crazy. I had tried doing some Last of Us multiplayer a couple weeks ago. And,
I haven't played Last of Us multiplayer in a pretty long time.
And it had been so long since I'd played Last of Us, I just didn't quite know what to do, and I got fucked so hard in that first couple matches, and I just, like, I was embarrassed. People were shouting at me, like, what are you doing? You used all our lives, and I just...
Go play Pac-Man, idiot!
Pretty much. I had to turn it off and be like, oh, I'll get back to it one day. I love this game, but I don't know. Maybe I'll just stick to single player.
Yeah, that... I can only imagine what the multiplayer scene is like now, because obviously I played it like 2 or 3 weeks after the game came out, where it's like everyone was sort of adjusting to it. And The Last of Us has probably hit that point in its multiplayer lifetime of like, the only people who are playing it are either people who just got the game or are getting fucked, or it's people who've been playing the multiplayer since the game came out and are really fucking good at it.
I know. Well, maybe next time I play the campaign on that, because I still want to do a Survivor run on that game. But
yeah.
In any case,
this has finished our The Last of Us podcast.
Yeah, no.
It's our sequel to
The Last of Us. All right, so this is a pretty long podcast. Like, you know, we're in a video game era right now for this podcast. We talked about some Grand Theft Auto. We talked about some Mass Effect. We talked about a little bit of Last of Us there. Next, we
talked a little bit about biblical floods, about Jonathan's lack to maneuver his body well in any way.
So why I have to play video games? Because in video games, I can be nimble. I can
Some I've seen you play video games. It depends on the game, I guess, but yeah.
No, but we'll talk Grand Theft Auto 5 next week. Probably some other stuff, too. Tokyo Game Show is sometime soon. We'll cover that.
Yeah, it's like in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Hopefully there'll be some other stuff to talk about, too, but we're getting into the thick of things.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, fucking the day the new consoles arrive is readily approaching. Yep.
I'm so psyched, man. I have so many games to finish before then, and that's stressing me out, but... Yeah. I just got Catherine 2 from Atlas.
Catherine 2?
Catherine.
I didn't realize they made a sequel to Catherine.
No,
Jesus.
Catherine also, which...
What the fuck have they been doing with my new Persona?
Right. Anyway, I was thinking of trying to play that over the weekend before Persona 5 came out, but after I finished Mass Effect, I realized I needed something much lighter, and Catherine is, it's an Atlas game. It probably would make me think. It's like, I need something that would make me think less. So I tried playing... This is a quick story before we log off.
This podcast is never-ending, motherfuckers.
You know, I told you the story, you guys, on the podcast a couple weeks ago, that I got Tomb Raider for $1 at Target, the new reboot.
Yeah, that's right.
I played the first hour and a half of Tomb Raider. Because
so
I thought...
maybe 90 minutes.
Yeah. So I was saying, I wanted to play something sort of light and just fun and a little more...
Yeah, so let's go play the game that in the advertisement, all they showed was Lara Croft being brutally tortured and, like, falling on pieces of, like, rusted rebar, covered in dirt in own blood.
I didn't see any advertisements.
Oh, okay. Because I saw the trailers, I was like, if I want a good old time, let's go play Tomb Raider.
I just
Lara
thought
Croft
it was...
Torture Simulator.
I thought it was going to be a fun adventure game, but Tomb Raider is so fucking dark. It's like Lara Croft and the Temple of Doom. You start that game...
Darker than that, dude.
I mean, one thing I love about it, though, is that it's got... You have like 2 minutes of cutscenes and you're playing. But what happens is, as soon as you start playing, you are tied up upside down with several corpses, and you have to get yourself free by literally lighting yourself on fire. You fall down, get impaled on rebar, get yourself up, have to crawl through a tomb of dead bodies and
like
all this shit.
Like a creepy dude starts chasing you, right?
Yep. Yeah. And then, like, if you die while the creepy dude is chasing you, the kill screen is you get crushed by a rock and decapitated. It is the most brutal fucking game.
Like, have you seen these, Conan O'Brien videos called Clueless Gamer?
No.
You really should. They're all on YouTube. They're really, really funny. And it's basically Conan O'Brien plays these, like, modern video games, and he's not a dude who plays video games at all, but obviously his, like, audience, like I like Conan, like, they play video games, so it's like, he gets this one, like, I think his web guy, who plays a lot of video games, comes with him, and sort of, like, guides him through playing these games, and they did an episode on Tomb Raider that I've watched, like, 5 times, because it's so fucking funny, and there's this one part in the game where Lara is, like, sliding down this river, and sort of, like, going, like, left and right, trying to avoid these, like, piles of branches and stuff. And if you hit the branch, it's like you get this, like, brutal, just gruesome 5-second shot of she gets, like, impaled through the neck, through the top of her head, and just, like, hangs there. And she's, like, grabbing onto it, like, gasping for breath because her fucking windpipe has just been punctured by this massive piece of wood. And then she just, like, dies. It's like, oh, my God. And, like, watching Conan's reaction to it because he's so terrible at playing the games. It's just, like, he does it, like, over and over. And it's like, oh... Like, you make me fall in love with this girl, and then I watch her die over and over and over again.
I mean, am I just completely out of the loop? Was Tomb Raider always this fucked up?
No, this is the gritty reboot. Okay. Like, they should have called it The Tomb Raider, and then it would have been obvious. Like, oh, this isn't Tomb Raider, this is The Tomb Raider. Like, I better take some fucking antidepressants before I play this fucking game.
The other thing about Tomb Raider that made me stop playing it was... And I'll get back to it eventually. I needed something lighter for the time. So I went back and... So then I
love that you played that game knowing what, seeing what I've seen about it. I love that you did that game.
I know.
It's just like, it's fucking like oh man, like I'm having a really bad week. I want to just watch a really lighthearted movie. Let me put in Saw.
Pretty much. But the other thing in Tomb Raider is graphically, it looks very similar to The Last of Us.
Yeah, that's true.
It controls very similarly, so I had this vibe of, you know, the saddest game I've ever freaking played. And it's like, oh god, I can't get away from this. Because, like, I was looking at my shelf, and I'm like, I could play some Last of Us multiplayer, but that's too dark.
Yeah.
I could play some Catherine, but it's probably too long, and I think I want something a little simpler right now. Maybe less story-heavy. And I thought Tomb Raider would be a nice balance of just maybe a fun archaeological adventure story. Yeah. Nope! It's, nope!
Man, go fucking play Uncharted, dude.
I know, like, I should.
Yeah, like, there's no reason to go to... If you want some happy, archaeological, like, crazy, wacky Indiana Jones adventure time... That's exactly what they made Uncharted for.
Right.
If you want to see a really cute, kind British, like, 18-year-old girl get brutally, like, tortured until to the point where she becomes a psychopathic killer, then you play Tomb Raider. That's, yeah, like, they're two very different things.
I can't wait until they do the Tomb Raider film reboot like this, man. Just...
Like, yeah, just watch Angelina Jolie just get impaled on a fucking, like, tree.
No, you have to get a young, like, 18-year-old British actress.
You can just, like, do the thing they did to Jeff Bridges in Tron Evolution for
Tron Angelina. Legacy.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
Two fucking subtitles. Yeah. Tron subtitle.
Alright. This podcast has gone on way too long.
Is there something else we can talk about? Have you gotten any further in Final Fantasy IV? Do we want to bring that up?
I played a little bit of it last... I kind of put Final Fantasy IV on the back burner when I was finishing Mass Effect, because I had, with the flood and everything, I had 4 days to just play Mass Effect. I had to play a little more Final Fantasy IV. It's a really good game.
Yeah, I've gotten to, like, the Dark World or whatever it is in that game.
I am not super far. I'm, like, 2 or 3 hours in. But
Yeah, I'm probably, like, 8 to 10 hours in.
Okay.
I think I might be getting kind of close to the end. I don't remember how long that game... I remember you go to the moon at some point. I haven't gotten there.
Okay.
I don't remember why you go to the moon. I just remember you do, and it's like...
It's going
to
be fun.
Yeah.
I just... Like I always have sort of a Vita game on standby for when I'm away from my consoles, and that's my Vita game right now. But yeah, I think I was mid-dungeon when I stopped. And,
See, never do that. Never stop mid-dungeon. Always stop, like, once you, like, get into a dungeon or you're out of a dungeon. That's always where I'd stop playing a game like that.
Well, especially in an old RPG like that, you get turned around and then you go back into B1 all over again. And...
Yeah, there's, like, no quest log or anything, because, like, I put the game down for, like, 3 or 4 days and I was like, oh, fuck. Yeah. I had to look up a walkthrough online because I had no idea what I was supposed to do anymore.
And here's the thing, it's the other thing that's bothered me is I went right into that dungeon after I got Edward, and Edward's fucking weak right when you get him. And
yeah, he's a fucking... Who gives a shit about bards?
I know.
What the worthless... fucking class that is, the bard. If you fucking play the lute, good for you, asshole. I'm glad he's not a party member for, like, the whole game. Like, he just gets sidelined eventually. It's like, thank God.
I don't think anyone is listening to this podcast anymore. We can say whatever we want now.
Fucking, let's go, let's just do reviews of every single Dragon Ball Z movie. Let's bring it back around to the Battle of Gods stuff.
Alright, between DBZ 1, 2, and 3 movies, which one's your favorite?
I hate how you know them by the number instead of by the title.
Well, but the titles in Japanese are super long, so I don't remember.
But just go by the fucking English that we're in America, asshole. There is just an accepted English nomenclature for the titles of all the names. I don't give a shit what the Japanese title is. I don't give a shit what the number is. Say the fucking name of the movie in English.
I don't remember the English titles for all 13. I know for 1, 2, 3, it's Dead Zone, World's Strongest, and Tree of Might.
Yes.
Tree of Life is the Terrence Malick movie. Okay. God, this is
just... They're very similar things.
I want, like, Terrence Malick to make a DBZ movie.
Yeah, that part where Brad Pitt comes down to Earth and then drinks or eats this fruit and becomes super powered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that part of that movie.
So, okay, Dead Zone, World's Strongest, Tree of Might. Yeah. It's Dead Zone. That's a fucking great one, but...
Yeah.
What's yours? Okay, 4, 5, 6. That's Slug something.
Yeah, Lord Slug in there.
Cooler 1 and Cooler 2.
Yeah. I really like the first cooler one I've always been kind of fond of. I haven't watched these movies in fucking years, though.
Well, Lord Slug is terrible. Cooler 1 and 2 are great.
But Lord Slug, I remember, has the part where they win because Gohan whistles. Because the Namekians have, like, super hearing or whatever. So.
That's kind of funny. That's also, they had not gotten to the point in the manga where Goku literally goes Super Saiyan.
Okay, so we're done. We have to stop now. This has gone on too far. I was hoping at some point you were just going to, like, hit stop while you're talking. This has gone too far.